Interim Committee on Veterans Emergency Preparedness to come to order. Colleagues and members of the public, we're going to have a little bit of an informational meeting ourselves here. We do not have any legislative concepts to introduce at the time. We have three items on our deal. We're going to talk briefly about the member, possible member bills, previews, and then a fuel action plan, resilience plannings, and then there is a joint public informational hearing next door for future veteran spending, and we're going to adjourn from here and move over there. I would advise everybody, if you didn't happen to your right, it's snowing outside. ODOT has a very good webpage called the Oregon Trip Oregon Trip Check, if you need to check the weather. If you do go next door to testify in the hearing that's next door and you are more than 100 or 50 miles away, please check that in the box so we can try and get individuals when we go next door out of here as quickly as possible and safely. If you're unable to testify due to weather and you have to leave the weather, please remember that all you need to do is go to OLS. You can find the good counsel, Cheyenne Ross's name on there. Click on it. It'll give you an email and you can submit your testimony that way. So the very first thing we're going to do is very briefly discuss committee member concepts that are going to come before us. I know that the good Senator Courtney is preparing a concept, and the good representative, if you'd like to come up here, if you would please, are preparing a legislative concept on oil train contingencies. So I don't know if he's going to join you or not. You notice we were sparring back and forth up here, and so it's up to him, but since ladies are first anyway, I'm going to let you proceed before the president because you are the guest in our chamber.
You are so kind. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Barbara Smith Warner, and I have the honor to represent House District 45, which is Northeast Portland, Maywood Park, and Park Rose in the Oregon State House. And thank you for the deferment, but I am here mostly to support and encourage my fine colleague, Senator Courtney. I worked through the 2015 session on a bill on oil train and hazardous material transport by train, which ended up establishing a new office in the State Fire Marshal's office where we are coordinating emergency response from. I am working on a new concept as well as Senator Courtney this time to come back to some other things that we weren't able to accomplish through that bill and that some of our neighbors to the north and south have done on contingency planning and some other stuff. But I'm going to defer to Senator Courtney on that, and I'm here to either answer any questions or tell you if my work is significantly differing from his, which I doubt.
Senator, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chair Boquist and Senator Olson, Senator Weymouth Sanderson. My name is Peter Courtney. I'm a state senator, District 11, and I've come here today to testify in favor of LC 2361, and as you know, on June 2nd, 2016, we had 16 train cars derail in Mosier. A puncture in a tanker car resulted in a 14-hour fire and the leaking of oil into adjacent creek and the Columbia River. The oil train originated in North Dakota. It was destined for the U.S. Oil and Refinery Company in Tacoma, Washington, with 94 tank cars loaded with bacon crude oil, according to the oil lobbying group, American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers. Baker crude is a very volatile, it contains high levels of combustible gases compared to oil from other sources. The tank cars were generally purposed what they called DOT 111 cars. They have been modified to CPC 1232 standards. Now, I'm not trying to show off, but this is all my staff, because one of my staff has worked for ODOT quite a while, and she actually got me very interested in this when she was describing all this and about what was going on. They are referred to as jacketed 1232s. Train cars built today are called DOTs 117s, which are stronger and safer than the 1232s. Experts say, had the DOT 117s been in use from Mosier oil spill, there would likely not have had been a puncture. The cars would not have punctured. So had those cars been involved, you would have had no puncture. Some would like to ban oil trains in Oregon, but that, you can't do that simply because of the Interstate Commerce Clause, and so that was not going to work. It would likely require the use of safe oil cars known as DOT-117s. Federal law won't let us do that and has pushed this requirement out in 2025. I had originally said I didn't want any. I was going to go and ask. I told the governor and the speaker, let's go get an injunction until all the cars can be these DOT-117s. One of the greatest manufacturers of these cars actually is out of Lake Oswego. But I don't know what ever happened with the Department of Justice. People went to vague on me. And then I found out that the federal government had originally required that all tanker cars be 117s. Somewhere, I think it was 2019 or 20, and then the Congress moved it back to 2025. So basically, I was in trouble there, and I couldn't get anywhere. So a federal law will allow Oregon to require contingency planning for oil train spills to make communities safer and to protect our environment. Nothing is free, and the oil transporters should be required to contribute to the planning fund. So the next thing I got interested in was this thing about a contingency emergency plan. And then this bill comes along. It adds railroad cars to the definition of facility for purposes of a liability for oil spillage under oil or hazardous material spillage statutes, defines high hazard train route, and listed sensitive area for purposes of continuing plans, established an annual assessment proportioned among certain railroads, and transfers money to oil spill prevention fund for purposes of certain activities related to high hazard trains. Long and short is, I don't have the sophistication knowledge that ODOT has, or the good representative have. You can't just say we're not going to allow any more trains. You can't say we're not going to allow any more trains until they have a certain. You remember the spillage, and out of that came double-hulled tankers. Well, the 117s are basically a double-hulled tanker car for trains. They're basically that, but we can't require that for reasons that are you just can't. The federal government, the federal law said you don't. They do want all that done one day, but not until 2025, which is a long time away. So this contingency plan thing is something that we don't now have and we should have. So that's what the purpose of the bill is. So we bring it here, and it's generated some interest, to say the least, and I'm surprised. Even the speaker said she's interested in this bill. Not that that should be persuasive, but I'm just saying I just went and introduced the bill, and all of a sudden people are getting interested. So I thank you. First time that I've ever talked about it publicly is here before my own committee. So I'm glad that you allowed me to at least speak to it, Your Honor.
Well, thank you, Senator Courtney, and we look forward to actually seeing the draft because I know it's still in process. It's not being worked. And Madam Representative, do you have more concepts or different concepts?
My concept is very similar. We have had some. One of the challenges in dealing with this, as Senator Courtney so aptly put it, is federal preemption. The Interstate Commerce Clause, there are a lot of things that we cannot do as a state in regard to this issue. And so we have spent a lot of time with Ledge Council and talking to people in other states about what can we do at a state level that will not be federally preempted. So one of the ways is figuring out, because we are a state that does not have any refineries, both Washington and California are able to assess fees to help pay for this the emergency response plan, because they can charge those fees at the refineries, because there's an endpoint where the oil comes in. You can charge per barrel, per car, whatever. Mm-hmm. Because we are merely a through state, that's another. It makes it hard for us to do that. So Senator Courtney's draft has a lot of similarities to mine in defining the cars, the high hazard areas. I think his idea of the environmentally sensitive areas is a great. That is what we have been working on is the idea of using. navigable waterways where train tracks pass over navigable waterways, and so that we can use a federal law, the Oil Spill Prevention Act, which happened after the Exxon Valdez, which lets us plan and charge fees for emergency response for oil traveling on the water. But navigable waterways, as you may be aware, has many other issues that are wrapped up in it. And so I am eager to work with Senator Courtney on that different idea on how to assess areas that we can get away from the very challenging navigable waterways. So that's exciting. And I also would like to point out that a lot of things that again, Washington, California have done, and that we even came in last year in 2015 talking about, have been worked out through rule. There has been a lot of collaborative work with the railroads and ODOT and this new office in emergency management and in the fire marshal's office, that there has been a lot of cooperation and coming together and sharing of information, which was a big sticking point before. So there have been a lot of progress on that, both through formal rulemaking and informal working together through this office. So I look forward to continuing that work next year with the good senator's assistance.
And thank you. And this committee definitely likes collaboration. The count is pretty simple, but this is a committee that traditionally on emergency preparedness, veterans, and other issues assigned to it tends to prefer to work together to find collaborative solutions. Yeah. Madam Vice Chair, questions? Senator Olson?
Yes. Thank you. On the assessment, do you have any idea what that would be and how much it would be?
I could not. I was going to say not the least of, because I haven't, I do not know. I don't know right now.
Chair of our question, Senator Wilson, I do not. We did not get into that kind of detail, but there would need to be one. But I do not know, and look to the collective wisdom of the committee perhaps to have some thoughts if you choose to support the bill. So I do not have anything specifically in mind, but an assessment, assessment is needed.
Is the Department of Energy involved in any of this? They're not.
They have not been so far.
But yet they have an emergency management team for toxic chemicals. Now, one would assume that you would consider this to be a toxic chemical.
Hazardous is the term that is the term we use in the language.
It is hazardous, but it is also extremely toxic.
That's a great idea.
I just wondered if the Department of Energy, because we're looking at what their function is, so I just wondered.
Yeah.
And the final question, if you may, mm-hmm. Do you know how many of the DOT-117s are available as compared to the 1232s?
I don't know a number. I would like to reinforce another thing Senator Courtney said, which is Gunderson has a whole retrofitting. This could be a great potential jobs bill for this state, and we talked a lot about this in 2015, because they have a whole retrofitting for these cars, and part of the frustration with the feds pushing back those requirements is the sooner those come, the more business that is for Gunderson to retrofit these cars. And there have been both shippers and rail lines that have moved up the requirement of transporting oil in those, that they strongly encourage more folks to do that, and there are oil companies that are doing that. But again, we are all hamstrung by the slowness of the federal regulations and how they move.
Senator Boquist, Chair Boquist, I could really have shown off 6 months ago if you'd asked me that question. Now I forgot it. I thought it took 6 months to make a 117. It takes them 6 months to make one. I thought, oh, come on, man, I could look real good here because you're from Purdue University. You're an engineer. I'd love to show off. Availability. They're out there. 117s are being used. They are out there, and you may know about. I can tell the way your body language. You know everything about this, and you're about. Why am I even telling you this? You know all about this. You can tell us. But all that are available are being used, if you know what I mean. All that are available, 117s are being used. It takes 6 months to make one, although you'd make more than one at a time. So I don't know where that fits into your question in terms of, let's say tomorrow we'd say you can't come through Oregon unless you have 117s. And I was told by Lake Oswego Company, you got to be a little careful, Peter, because you can't just do a switch like that because the cars aren't available, et cetera, et cetera. And you're going to get economic pressure from companies because they got to replace the fleets. And they have bought the 1232s, the amortization, you know what I mean? They're trying to get that out of it. So you're going to have, there is going to be a pushback there. And that's why they kicked it out to 2025, to be frank with you, because they figure by then, it's all over. You've got to have them by then. So we don't have a backlog of that. We don't have a bunch of them in a freight place waiting for people to take them. But they're being made. I just don't know enough about the industry as to where, how to answer that question with the kind of details that you're, I'm sure you're looking for. I don't know.
Well, Mr. President, our chair has very tight connections with the new administration, so maybe he can bump that up to 2010 or 2019 or something like that, right?
Yeah. I'm part of the establishment. Right. I don't think they'll return my calls any more than they'll return the governor's.
Yeah, there you go. I got you.
I sort of wish, maybe you've seen, I wish I brought a picture of this thing. The 1232s and the 117s. Sounds like we're talking about bombers. But, you know, you would have been fascinated to see the design of these, and maybe you've seen them, how they look, and you'd realize why the 117, you really want 117s as opposed to what I call knockoff 117s, which is the 1232, which is basically, they try to modify it in a way, but it doesn't have the strength or the that you really got to have to deal with this. You need the 117s.
Well, the 1232s have redone the shutoff valves on the bottom and protected those from getting knocked off and stuff like that, right?
Yep.
But they're still not the double wall.
That's exactly
and
right.
And I think they're thicker. I think they're single, but it's thicker.
Yeah.
As
yes.
well. It goes from half to two-thirds or something like that.
There's a lot of difference between double-plated and double-walled, though.
Follow up. In your discussions and looking at this, have you talked to the railroads to find out what their new protocols are? Because they've really changed their protocols.
Chair Boquist, I have not talked to them. I have talked only to those who make the cars. I have not actually talked to them.
Maybe we could bring in those guys and have them tell us what their new protocols are, too, because they have new protocols on checking the track and stuff like that, because they admitted they blew it. So maybe we can find out from them what their protocols are, and then it'll take away a little bit of the fear of the 1232s saying that, hey, we're doing this now instead of what we did do. Just as, you know, not to say that we should take away from this, but just to say we have taken new extra measures to protect this.
Well, whatever the committee does, we need to do it collaboratively and integrated so that we have a solution, because we need to protect the environment and protect our jobs and protect our future at the same time. So look forward to hearing more. Of course, we haven't seen it. It hasn't come out of legislative council yet. You never know what our lawyers are going to do. And so once it comes out, we'll look forward to seeing your bill, too. The one ask I have, since we invited you graciously to our chamber to sit with a good presiding officer, is that when yours does come out, let us know so that Cheyenne can make sure we see that bill, too.
Great.
And you know, if there's going to be a collaborative effort, then we want to make sure we work together versus coming up with opposing perspectives.
Great.
So to speak. Thank you very much.
Happy
Appreciate
to.
It.
Thank you.
Madam Vice Chair, do you have any bills you want to tell us about that you're introducing?
Oh.
Oh, yes.
Yes, we have a bill.
Okay. Yes, we do.
And I'm not prepared to talk about it.
Then you can talk about it next meeting.
Thank you. Okay. It has been
dropped.
Okay. And we will have a bill number.
Senator Olson, any bills that you want us to be...
I actually have an LC on property tax exemptions for 100% disabled veterans, and we've modified the amounts for those that are 40 to 100%. Moved those up a little bit, but the difference being is we tried this 2 years ago, and the counties were upset because we demanded that they do it, and we don't know the total number. Well, we have an idea of the total number of 100% disabled, but we're not sure where they all live and what it would cost the counties. So I want to change this bill to say change it from they must do it to they shall do it. They can do it if they want to, and they can set the criteria as to be determined if you're 100% disabled and you can't work, can you get the discount? Or if you can work and you're living a full and viable life, but you're still dedicated or determined by the VA that you're 100% disabled, then maybe you would fall at the lower level, but you would still get an exemption, but not the full one. And I'm going to allow the counties to ferret out, you know, whether they give the full exemption or the partial exemption. And then also, I just was asked this today, if we could add surviving spouses of active duty military members that were killed in a war, can they get a property tax exemption like the firemen and the policemen we just gave last year for $250,000? Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to introduce a bill for that one, too, so that if we have a surviving spouse, they can get a property tax exemption for the sacrifice of their significant other.
Thank you. With that, we're going to move down our informational area to the Fuel Action Plan. If Ms. Henry and Mr. Harriman want to make your way up to the fine diocese. I don't know who's leading and following. It's easy with representatives. I can just tell one of them to do it, but obviously there's an order or a rhyme to the reason
Peter,
to
your
folks' presentation. So I'll let whoever's going to lead and whoever's going to follow.
Chair Boquist and Vice Chair Mons Anderson and Senator Olson. I'm Mike Harriman, the State Resilience Officer, and I'd like to ask a clarifying question because we also have my understanding we were going to do the next presentation at the joint group for mass care, mass displacement, the resiliency update. So I think we're going to do it jointly. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct. After this, recess briefly and go next door.
Thank you.
You start again with the panel.
Well, we're here today. I'm with Ms. Deanne Henry from the Department of Energy. And Deanne's going to give an overview of the fuel supply in emergency settings for the state of Oregon. The Oregon Resiliency Plan from 2013 was introduced to the 77th legislative session, and there were some recommendations in there. One of the recommendations was the liquid fuel supply. So Ms. Henry's going to give you an overview. She's been working on this since 1999, and those of us that know Deanne, she's the first person we call when we want to find out something about emergency fuel allocations and rations in fuel. And it was paramount during the four-day exercise in June for the Cascadia Rising exercise that at the end of the 4 days we ran out of fuel to the coastal community hospitals. We have 11 hospitals along the coast. We could not even game plan out a delivery system, and hospitals are required to have 96 hours of fuel, so that's 4 days. And that would have added even a greater burden to the state and the communities to evacuate those patients then that they were still in the hospital. So this is our number one Achilles heel when it comes to resources, fuel for the state of Oregon. With that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Henry.
Thank you, Mike. Chair Wilquist, Vice Chair Monis Anderson, and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about the Oregon Fuel Action Plan today. I do want to give you a little bit about our agency's authorities, talk about the federal-state response structure in which we operate, and then talk about generally how we get fuel in the state under normal conditions before delving into our Oregon Fuel Action Plan and our strategies for getting fuel to those in the impacted areas after a catastrophic earthquake, and then highlight some of the key lessons learned from this exercise that we all participated in. In a state declared emergency, the governor has emergency powers to control, restrict, and regulate the use of fuel after a catastrophic earthquake. It's our agency's responsibility to develop a statewide contingency plan and maintain it with strategies to ensure that there are adequate fuel supplies to maintain emergency services, transportation, the operation of our economy, and to protect the welfare of our citizens throughout the entire emergency. In every emergency, there are 18 critical lifelines and services that, should they be disrupted for any length of time, could jeopardize our public health and safety, our region's economy, and, depending on the severity, our national security. We call these critical lifelines and services emergency support functions, or ESFs, and each ESF sector has a designated lead state agency and a designated lead federal agency. So the Department of Energy share that lead responsibility over ESF 12, the energy sectors, with the Public Utility Commission. The Public Utility Commission oversees the emergencies involving electricity and natural gas, while our agency takes a lead on petroleum, nuclear, and liquefied natural gas emergencies, with our lead agency, the federal agency, being the U.S. Department of Energy. So under normal circumstances like today, we are on a quarterly conference call schedule with USDOE and 14 15 other Western states to track issues of mutual concern and of joint interest. But during emergencies like Hurricane Sandy and Katrina, U.S. DOE does conduct daily conference calls with all 50 states so that we could assess petroleum impacts to the sector nationwide. This just allows the states to get a snapshot of what was happening across the country so that we can better anticipate problems closer to home and request federal support as needed. Oregon is extremely vulnerable to petroleum emergencies because we do not have any refining capabilities in state, so we do import 100% of our petroleum products. The bulk of that supply do come from four refineries located in the Puget Sound area of Washington State. They provide the bulk of that fuel to us by a pipeline that travels 230 miles into Oregon, and the remainder come by ship, and all of this fuel enters into Oregon at the Port of Portland, where seven petroleum distribution terminals are located, sitting on very liquefiable soils. We call this our Portland fuel hub, and we do get a small amount of fuel from Utah and California refineries. But once the product reaches the Portland fuel hub, we do use two pipelines, barge service on the Columbia River, and a fleet of about 1,500 tanker trucks to distribute fuel throughout the state to some 2,400 retail fueling outlets. While our system is very effective, it does lack flexibility at all levels, so these four refineries have been operating at near capacity for decades. This means that there is no ability to produce additional fuel to meet any increase in demand. At our Portland fuel hub, we are on a six-day fueling cycle. That means that we have less than a week's worth of reserve on hand at any given time. And at the local level, depending on storage capacity, the average service station has a 2 to 3 day supply. So this is under normal conditions. Another challenge that we face is that the petroleum infrastructure is an aging...
Would you take a question, ma'am?
Yes.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yes.
Because you were talking about the Portland hub with fuel and all that, and I was just going to ask you the question. You know that Portland wants to preclude any new construction of any new storage. Where, if that happens, where would we have an opportunity to put new storage? And if it does happen, how's that going to affect us in an emergency?
Senator Olson, that's a great question. And the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries have preferred locations where they would like to have an alternate site, and that would be either the Dalles or Boardman, the Port of Boardman, because it's on solid bedrock. The problem is moving this whole infrastructure with pipelines and facilities and the siting process. So that would be the alternate locations that are proposed.
A follow-up?
Go ahead.
If we put one down in the Dalles, would it be feasible to load barges here and take them down just for an alternate storage spot? Or would that be too expensive?
That there are probably a lot of fees involved with that. And I think for us all to keep in mind, it doesn't matter where the ultimate alternate location might be. After a catastrophic earthquake, our greatest challenge still is to get fuel into the impacted areas. So another challenge we have is that aging infrastructure. And Dogami had a 2013 study that revealed that the Olympic pipeline that provides the bulk of our supply was largely constructed in the 1960s when catastrophic seismic vulnerabilities were unknown. So this pipeline was built and designed without any consideration to those vulnerabilities. So we can expect widespread damage along the entire line after a catastrophic earthquake. Dogami's study also revealed that out of the hundreds of tanks in the Portland fuel hub, only three are expected to survive. Whether they will be operational after an earthquake remains to be seen. So these are the three newer tanks that was built after 2004 when the city of Portland started requiring all new constructions, including tanks, to address liquefaction concerns. And then finally, Dogami's report showed that the three marine docks that are currently permitted permitted to receive fuel by ship won't likely survive a moderate earthquake, let alone a catastrophic one. And our agency does not have any regulatory authority to require any of these companies make seismic upgrades to their pipeline systems, tank farms, or marine docks. But what we are responsible for is ensuring that we can respond to an emergency as if it were to happen tomorrow, to address those infrastructure problems with this current state, with all of its vulnerabilities. Knowing this, we have developed the Oregon Fuel Action Plan that addresses how we would bring fuel in from outside of the region to support our emergency response activities. This is a unique plan, and it's received a lot of national attention recently. We were invited just last month to present our plan to the National Emergency Management Association, where over 400 participants heard our plan and was very well received, and they're awaiting the release of our plan that will be finalized in the first quarter of 2017, which we will share with all of our stakeholders. Our plan does identify 9 priority actions that our agency will take in the aftermath of an earthquake to start restoring the infrastructure. It provides strategies and protocols that talk about how we would assess impacts to the infrastructure, estimate repair timelines, talks about how we would help assess the fuel needs of our priority users and how we would facilitate the delivery of fuel to pre-designated receiving sites for bulk fuel supplies throughout the state. It also talks about how we would coordinate with federal, military, and industry partners to bring that bulk fuel supply in from outside of the region. And then finally, it does identify federal and state laws that might impede the process, and we need to waive those regulations temporarily to ensure timely delivery of fuel. And all our work is allocating fuel to our emergency services to save lives and restore critical infrastructure, and that is a huge undertaking because Oregon has 120 state agencies with varying degrees of responsibilities for emergency duties. We have 24 counties and 240 cities that all have their own emergency and essential services providers and 9 federally recognized tribes. So if our agency were to receive fuel requests from all of these entities individually, we would simply be overwhelmed. So we have streamlined our process and developed a fuel allocation structure that can actually be managed. So now those who qualify for fuel fall under 3 major categories. It's the 18 state lead agencies overseeing critical sectors, our 36 counties, and the 9 federally recognized tribes. And all of our priority users have responsibilities. They have to have identified their critical missions, understanding some of the fuel needs needed to perform those missions, as well as work with our agency to pre-designate receiving sites that we call fuel points of distribution. And then the counties have additional responsibilities. They do have to work with all of their cities, special districts, and regional governments to do this work. And once we deliver the bulk fuel supplies to the counties, they are responsible for having a plan to deliver that fuel from the point of distribution to all of their emergency workers in the field and to their critical facilities. And we're also working with the tribes to get this work done as well. How quickly we can move fuel will be heavily dependent on our viable transportation routes, communication systems, and power grid. These are essential elements to moving fuel. Allocating fuel will require the full support of our entire agency. This is our agency structure for a full activation of our Emergency Operations Center to do fuel allocation. So this past year, we did participate in 2 federally sponsored exercises. The first was Clear Path 4, which is an energy sector specific exercise sponsored by the U.S. Department of Energy in preparation for Cascadia Rising. And so these 2 exercises really helped us improve our overall coordination and understanding of the federal response structure and how it directly integrates with the Oregon Fuel Action Plan. And of particularly worthwhile note is that during Clear Path 4, we activated a National Fuel Task Force where we were able to sit in the same room with the oil companies, the military, and the federal agencies and talk through how bulk supplies would be obtained and delivered into Oregon. So having a better understanding of the process, we were able to focus directly on Cascadia Rising to do what tests are components of our plan to determine how where we're going to put the fuel once it arrives in Oregon. So one of the first things is that our agency would do is to request fuel supplies. But while we're doing that, that takes time, even with the support of a national fuel task force. So state emergency responders will be using in-state supplies within their jurisdictions initially to perform those search and rescue and life-saving functions until we can bring in an alternate fuel supply. So our plan also has a database that identifies all above ground and underground storage tanks throughout the state by county. It includes fuel type, storage capacity, and identifies those locations with backup power. So during the exercise, we worked with Clackamas, Marion, and Washington counties to assess the fuel supplies in their county based on these spreadsheets, talk about how long this fuel supply might last them until we can bring in an alternate source, and as well as validate those pre-designated locations in their counties that we would be delivering fuel to. So our goal, these three counties have very extensive fuel plans, and it integrates very well with the state plan. But our goal is to continue working with the other counties, focusing on all those counties west of the Cascades to ensure that their fuel planning is underway as well. So one of the first things we did do during this exercise was request bulk fuel supplies formally to the federal government. Even with the federal agency's new push strategy, where they automatically bring in resources into the state, fuel is not one of those commodities, so it requires a formal request from our agency. And we demonstrated that during the exercise. And the federal agencies brought in 450,000 gallons as an initial delivery, and then subsequent 250,000 gallons on a daily basis into the Redmond Airport, which is the designated federal incident support base. So from there, we moved the bulk fuel supplies to three state staging areas in Portland, Salem, and Medford airports. And then from there, we airlifted fuel bladder bags, about 3,000 gallon bags, to seven public works yards in the counties to support those missions in the impacted areas. So what we learned here that was a key lessons learned was that airports are not the ideal locations as receiving sites, because generally they only accommodate jet fuel and aviation gas. So it's public works yards, ODOT yards, motor pools are better capable of receiving and storing unleaded and diesel fuel. So we'll make sure that our sites all accommodate those fuels.
Let me stop you and ask you just a question, because, and I'll leave most questions to the point when you actually come back with the fuel plan. But what you're talking about is during the Cascadia exercise, so on and so forth, tabletop exercises, not actually moving fuel, right?
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
This is a ringer of a question, because I already know the answer, so I'm very curious to this, is that, as you pointed out, you have to bring fuel in from the outside, and the both FEMA, the military, and everybody else in this whole Cascadia exercise found that they were overly optimistic on their capacity, and so they make nice good figures, but reality is quite a different. Your coordination with the fire marshal who regulates the fuel storage, right? How many of the card lock facilities out there do you believe, or does the Department of Energy believe, actually has backup power?
Chair Boquist, the fire marshal's office does have a list of all those locations with backup power, and I don't have the number right with me, but I could provide you with that list.
Okay. Go on. All right, I have the list already.
Okay.
Right, and we passed a bill. So, I mean, my observation that's jumping out here is we've been working on this issue for a long time, and DOE has not been at the table, and I think it's due to your efforts and Mr. Harriman's efforts that you're finally coming to the table, because we've been discussing this particular issue for about 6 years here, trying to figure out how to skin this cat. So it's good that somebody's taking the lead. So please go on.
Okay, thank you. So while the initial air response is vital to getting supplies into an impacted area, including fuel, Also, rapidly recovering the state lifeline routes is vital to gaining a sustained response. So during the exercise, we did work with ODOT and the PUC to coordinate sending out fuel trucks with power crews, utility crews, and road crews to start restoring those critical lifelines and to start reconnecting major population centers in the state. And we realized that we went well beyond the four-day exercise scenario, but we took this as an opportunity with all the experts and knowledge in the room to talk through some of these things so that we test those components of our plan. So what we did was we did use ODOT's lifeline routes and started working from there. And we do know that the next piece is start working with the counties to make sure they have priority routes that connect to the state lifeline route so we can get supplies in. And what you're looking at is Marion County's plan. Clackamas County, as well as Washington County, has already done this work as well. But they have identified Tier 1 routes that connect with the state lifeline routes, as well as pre-designated 9 fuel points of distribution to receive fuel and other disaster relief commodities. So, again, we want to work with all of the counties to make sure that this work is done. And those in the shaded areas are counties that are well underway in doing those plans, and the others we will work with as well. Some of the other things that we talked through during Cascadia Rising was moving fuel by water and by rail, because routinely we have barges that ship product from the fuel hub up to an eastern Washington distribution terminal. So we can expect that after a Cascadia quake that there will be barges trapped upriver from all of the down debris and bridges. And so the question is, how many barges do we have and how quickly can we get a fuel source? Because the intent is to use the barges storage facilities so that we offload fuel to support emergency response activities. And then rail as well. We receive shipments from the Midwest to the Portland fuel hub. The intent is to use rail cars to deliver fuel closer to the impact zone and serve as storage and dispensing locations for emergency response activities. Again, this will depend on the condition of the tracks and the availability of rail cars. So we'll continue working those details. There are maritime assets that we can also request, and we talk through this with the military department, and depending on the type of vessel, it takes up to a week to a month to receive the asset once it's been requested, and they could support us by delivering fuel as well as providing portable fueling locations. And then finally, we did identify and review those waivers that may need to be lifted to ensure that we have a timely delivery of fuel and other commodities. And the Department of Justice at this point is reviewing those waivers to see what the state needs to do to ensure that we can do that in a timely manner when needed. And that's just kind of a quick summary of where we've been and where we're headed. So lots of work to be done. Thank you for the opportunity.
Are you next? Are you wrapping up?
Chair Bokus, we are done with this presentation, so I think I'd like to wait until we go to the joint side, and then we'll do the mass care, mass displacement update for the resiliency update. That was a piece we'll do under the joint side.
We have a joint, and when you joint,
we're out of fuel, and we're getting ready to displace. Okay,
I got it.
So Mr. I appreciate your presentation. I think most of us look forward to seeing what it says when it comes out.
Okay.
I will tell you that we have been working at this for a decade here in the building and fuel planning for quite some time, and there's been multiple work groups involving multiple agencies, and your agency hasn't been one of those agencies. So what I do want to ensure now that we have a resilience coordinating officer is that we get everybody looped into the deal, because the choke point are twofold. First is pumping, because there's no power and there's no backup generation. There's no hookups for backup generations at all but two of the card locks. And as you well know, service stations don't do very well for dumping fuel in and using supply points. And the most prolific planner on this that we've seen to date in the last decade is ODOT. So if you're coordinating with ODOT, that is quite helpful to come around the bars. But we have a long ways to go because you can't do anything on that map. You can't even go down the 18 list of that you want to go down to, because when there's no fuel, you can't get from point A to point B.
Senator Boquist, on November 21st, I did hold a meeting for what I called a fuel planning coordination meeting, and we had all six regulatory state agencies that have some piece to do with fuel. We had ODOT, Department of Energy. We also had some locals come to the meeting and some nonprofits just to start a conversation about this, bringing all the characters together, connecting the dots, and we will continue to do that throughout the next session. And if there's any bills that are introduced that come to this committee addressing fuel, I'll be able to help work with the committee and then bring the appropriate staff from the other agencies and the industry as well. So we'd like to hear from the industry ourselves.
Since the chair mentioned the fact that there was no backup generation, the facilities don't have generators that they can pump with, you might want to consider that when the power lines are down, the utilities, one of the first things they get to is to put power into these stations and get that taken care of so that we can at least generate some opportunity to draw fuel rather than let that be, you know, hospitals will probably be first, but fuel ought to be second.
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson and I will work with those responding agencies. That's their primary task in life is to send those crews out and make sure they get that message.
Right. And the only other suggestion I have is you have to get private sector. We have no storage capacity in the government. Everything that you mentioned, as you well know, when it liquefies up there, the two that are remaining won't be there either because it could be burning. Okay, it's just the way it goes. None of the major aviation facilities will have fuel storage, as you know, because they're sitting on liquefied soil as it goes across the board. And, you know, if you don't know, and I don't know if you do know because at this point, because it's the first time we've seen you, is that, you know, we have put a program together to start putting generator drops in at least the first 25 largest and most critical card lock facilities out there so that we can generate power to get stuff moving, because without fuel, I just need to tell you that if the military is promising you 7 days, I had a closed door discussion with them after that meeting you had, and it is much longer. And so we're on our own. We're completely on our own. And when you don't have food and water for 14 to 30 days, you don't need the other people to come back after 30 days. So we have to overcome this. So I appreciate the hard work your agency is doing. I appreciate the hard work you're doing, so on and so forth. With that, we're going to recess and move next door.
So we will. Veterans and Emergency Preparedness to order.
Senate Committee.
So now we're going to, next on our agenda is a short conversation dealing with the resilience planning next steps. We have on the phone Jay Wilson. Jay, are you still on the phone?
Jay, are you there? Jay, are you there?
We don't have him on the phone anymore.
Next. And Jay's not there.
Try to reconnect him there after a while.
Okay.
Jay, if you're there, yeah. You... Oh, oh. Probably
just take
it on.
Takes a woman's time. <dash.
laughs> Thank you. We're sorry for the delay, Jay, but thanks for staying on the phone. And Mike, here he is. Thanks, Mike. Come on up. And whoever else. Introduce yourself for the record.
Yes.
Chair Lively, Chair Boquist, and members of the joint committees. My name is Mike Herrmann. I'm the State Resilience Officer. And today we're here to talk about mass care and mass displacement. And you asked me why, and I'll say in 2013, the Oregon Resiliency Plan had 9 chapters introduced in the 77th legislation. Chapter 9 was titled Looking Ahead. And inside Looking Ahead was focused on community resiliency. Yeah. And so based on the Cascadia Rising exercise, I brought together a group in October to talk about mass care and mass displacement. These committees also during the 2015 session had an opportunity to look at Senate Bill 808, which was introduced to do a task force. So this is a follow-on from that. With me today is Mr. Stan Thomas from the Department of Human Services, and on the phone is Mr. Jay Wilson. Jay is the chair of the Oregon Seismic Safety and Policy Advisory Committee. Not with me today, but with yesterday, we were had the opportunity to brief the interim House Healthcare Committee that's chaired by Representative Greenlick. At that particular meeting yesterday, hearing Commissioner Leanne Thompson from the Association of Oregon Counties, Clapsa County, asked me, who's not here today, to read her one-page statement, and I'd like to do so. And so this is in her handwriting, so here we go. Thank you, Chair Lively and Chair Boquist, and members of this committee for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Leanne Thompson, and I am heavily involved in preparing Oregon's coastal communities for disaster. While I am a community emergency response team member, trained in a member of the Medical Reserve Corps, and a board member, licensed in ham radio, and president of the ham radio club that maintains the repeater system linking Clapsa County to the outside world. And she's a volunteer with the Red Cross. I'm actually here today as both a Clapsa County commissioner and the co-chair of the Association of Oregon County's Public Safety Subcommittee on Resiliency. This subcommittee met for the first time on Monday and is already working to improve resiliency of Oregon counties and communities. In the event of a 9.0 magnitude earthquake along the Cascadia subduction zone, the resulting tsunami, survival and recovery will depend heavily upon how well nonprofits, businesses, government at all levels integrate and coordinate their response. The Cascadia Rising exercise earlier this year was designated to simulate this event and stress our test of emergency management systems. And in that, it was a success. There were a variety of challenges that were both expected and not, and learning from these experiences is part of the important work ahead of us. The coordination direction of Mike Harriman is taking to learn from the Cascadia Rising exercise, as well as identify other resilience best practices, is encouraging. This integration and cooperation will continue to improve as more partners come together to address our joint concerns and issues. One of the items we have identified is the need for human services, medical care, and shelter for thousands of displaced people in the event of a Cascadia earthquake. If the earthquake were to happen over the 4th of July weekend in Seaside, we'd see over 100,000 more people without a place to go. There will not be any routes back over the coastal range, and much of our existing housing will have been jeopardized by the earthquake, if not demolished by the tsunamis. This means that in her community, there will be thousands of people with nowhere to stay and nowhere to receive care for weeks. There are a variety of opportunities to enhance our preparedness and mitigate the consequences of these circumstances. The one I'd like to focus on today is the develop sustainable energy housing near the coastal area. I have been working in my county to build capacity for sustainable and modular housing with improved resilience. Chair Lively, Chair Boquist, I look forward to working with you and the other members of this committee to improve resilience throughout Oregon. Please keep myself and the AOC Resilience Subcommittee in mind as you are considering how best to improve the preparedness, survival, and recovery of Oregon's counties. Signed, Commissioner Leanne Thompson, Clapsa County. So with that, I'd like to then turn it over to Mr. Wilson on the phone, and he has some comments as the chair of OSPAC.
Okay. You're up, Jay.
Afternoon. Chair Lively, Chair Boquist, I'm looking online and it looks like there's quite a delay between what's actually being put on the internet, and so I'm speaking quite blindly to my audience there in the hearing room, but I appreciate the opportunity for this invited testimony here at the onset of the 2017 session. The place where we are right now in the Oregon Resilience Plan is that in 2013, we delivered the plan to the legislature. In 2015, we had a number of bills, and all of these were tied to the original direction for the focus on infrastructure. But at that time, in 2015, OSPAC also decided we needed to work on the next steps that we identified then that revolved around community resilience and primarily people and society. And that's where we are now going into 2017, is we have a number of suggestions for areas that we believe would be tremendous investments in the direction we need to take for community resilience. And one of them is this issue of mass displacement. We understand that tens of thousands of residents of Oregon will be displaced. this event occurs, especially on the coast. I just heard an updated 2010 census number for the tsunami evacuation zone of being around 33,000 permanent residents that we could expect would not have a place to return home to afterwards, not to mention along the I-5 corridor. And one of the biggest issues when you look at this type of dislocation and the community disruption that that we're anticipating is the loss of not just protecting the lives, but the livelihoods that are attached to where people live and that community connection. And then the resulting impacts to the health care, for example, that many people manage on their own in their homes, but with the loss of all the services that are attached, and whether they're displaced or not, their health care can start spiraling, and what could be a manageable level of welfare that they have could quickly become acute and be an even bigger issue for the limited medical facilities that we have. But the other side of it, too, is with the infrastructure breakdowns, with water, with wastewater, we're really seeing this as a humanitarian crisis in the way that we've seen in places like in Haiti, for example. And I would never think about comparing Oregon to that community, but it doesn't take a lot when you start breaking these things to quickly realize that the health and sanitation issues can become, you know, critical life and health safety issues for communities. And so in bringing this up right now, we're asking for serious investments over the next 2 years. We like the idea of a task force that was suggested before to bring the top-down and ground-up approaches for all the community services that are active on a day-to-day basis that will be even more important when this event occurs, and that we have all this day-to-day decision-making that we're doing right now that either is buying more capacity and criticality to what we're doing, or if we stay the course with kind of business as usual, we're actually building in a lot more vulnerability as we go along. And so 2 years from now, the idea would be we would come back to the full legislature with a strategy, with a long-term set of priorities and programmatic approaches that would be, you know, very well thought out, deliberated on, and give us a much better focus on what the context of the issues are and the interconnectedness there. Because right now, yesterday, Representative Kenny Geyer asked the question, how much is all of this going to cost? And I thought it was a great question, but it's a question that we couldn't answer with a straight face because we don't have our head around all of the issues that are involved here. And I think it would take that amount of time for us to come up with something as complex as this. The infrastructure piece that we worked on in 2013 in some ways is much more straightforward and simple than the human dimensions of this issue. And I think a longer-term approach is what's going to be warranted here if we're going to seriously come up with priorities for the legislature to consider 2 years from now.
Thank you, Ryan. Okay.
Good.
Chair Lively, Chair Boquist, Vice Chairs, and members of the committee, my name is Stan Thomas. I'm the Emergency Preparedness and Business Continuity Program Manager for the Department of Human Services. And as part of that work and what lies on my desk is what we call Emergency Support Function 6, Mass Care, and Emergency Support Function 11 out of the Emergency Operations Plan. So our agency helps facilitate the statewide response in the aftermath of a significant disaster like the Cascadia subduction zone. I want to say, as an emergency manager and a Air Force veteran, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you about this today. So one of the things that Cascadia Rising taught us is in going through that four-day exercise and anticipating the needs, and we're talking about the damage assessments from the earthquake and the resultant tsunamis that would be coming into shore, about 1.5 million people will need some type of emergency relief supplies in the aftermath of a catastrophic event such as that. The mass care, to define that a little bit, when we talk about mass care, we talk about the folks that survive the disaster that do not need advanced medical care. ESF 8 and Oregon Public Health manage that operation. We work very closely with them, but we're talking about food, water, ice, emergency needs, which I call the toilet paper and teddy bears, the shelters. And the other thing that we have to work with is the mass displacement that Mr. Wilson spoke about. Where are we going to move those people, and how are we going to maintain those operations? The Department of Human Services is also responsible or the lead agency for in the draft recovery plan for social services. And we have to understand the impact that we're going to have in the long term of the hundreds, if not thousands, of people that are going to require services in the short term and sometimes in the long term. Those are some of the things that we really try to, it's hard to wrap our brain around. And the question that we received yesterday, how do you pay for all of this? You know, that's a question that we hope we never have to answer. But I can say that for a dollar spent on resiliency and for a dollar spent on preparedness, we'll save hundreds of dollars per dollar afterwards. So it's important that we wrap our heads around this today. DHS in 2014 kind of took wanted to refocus its efforts in this area of mass care, food and water. And one of the things that we started working on is to strengthening the partnerships that we have with agencies and organizations that we were already working closely with. The Red Cross and the Oregon Food Bank were here yesterday. Given the weather outside and the storm moving in and the uncertainty of this evening, they felt, and I agree, that it was better that they stay a little close to home today. Their testimony has been submitted to you in writing. The Oregon Food Bank submitted last week, and I dropped off the Red Cross's testimony this morning. They are significant partners, and without them, we fall on our knees. The NGOs and the other agencies that we work with are critical. Acknowledging that, we're trying really hard to work with new partners. Oregon volunteer organizations active in disasters, DHS, we reach out to them and work very closely with them to try to get those unaffiliated groups through the ORVOADs and the COADs to come in, because they're going to be our frontline defense out on the coast. The Veterans Administration, Employment Division, Salvation Army, those groups were trying to kind of build a coalition, so to speak, of organizations that come together. One agency is not going to fix any of this. So it's definitely going to take a community of agencies and organizations to move forward. One of the things that we have worked on as a result of, and are beginning to work on, as a result of the Cascadia Rising exercise, is logistical operations. We just heard from Ms. Henry from the Oregon Department of Energy in the previous meeting about how the fuel is going to be distributed. The commodities need to stay very close to the fuel, so we have to coordinate those operations. And we're starting to work with the Department of Energy, Department of Administrative Services, Oregon Emergency Management, to try to get that moving. One of the things that we also started to set up in 2014 and in early 2015 was, how do we organize this work that's being done, and how do we organize the structure? We went with the task force structure. The task forces that we've identified right now that would be necessary would be a sheltering task force, feeding task force for disaster feeding, access and functional needs, which is extremely critical because that's a population that is really going to require a lot of attention to make sure that they're protected and that they're taken care of. Children and families, disaster housing, behavioral health, social services, and there's others that we could add, but that's kind of the structure that we're working around. The challenge with that, bandwidth and resources with all of the organizations, there's not a lot there. So although we've identified the structure, a lot of those task forces really haven't been filled and gotten off the ground. I will say that we are embarking in 2017, Department of Human Services and the Oregon Food Bank, on trying to develop a disaster feeding plan for Oregon. We were honored to be invited to the national strategy meetings to develop a national disaster feeding program. Dean Albee from the Oregon Food Bank basically represented Oregon. He's very knowledgeable, and we're trying to take what we learned from the national planning efforts and incorporate that into Oregon. We hope to have that plan drafted and even hopefully tested by the end of 2017. I think with that, I'm going to open it up for questions. And I can't emphasize enough that moving forward, we have a large, extremely large challenge in front of us, dealing with the immediate aftermath of the Cascadia subduction zone event, or another event, even large wildfires, could bring around a response that was necessary and critical. I think over the last 3 or 4 years, we've been close to where small communities have had some damage, but we could have large communities have a lot of damage, similar to what happens in Washington and California the last few years. But it's going to take a concerted effort from all levels of government, from the counties, the cities, the state, and also our federal partners coming in to assist us. With that, I'll leave it for any questions.
Questions? Any members have questions? Representative Parrish.
Thanks. So I like this chart with the management functions. What I don't see or would like to see, if it's available, is the prioritization of, you know, some of the tasks underneath what these groups would do, right? So in an event, you know, kind of what, because I get asked the question, well, what's the first thing the government's going to do if, you know, there's an event? And I'm like, well, they're, you know, going to make sure the government's still standing, right? I mean, you have to then be able to deploy out police and fire, and we've tried to do that, shore up some of those buildings and things in our own community just because of that. But I think the public would, you know, kind of is interested in making sure that, you know, because I tell folks, you know, if you're expecting us to come for you and you really don't have a disability, even if it's a food issue, no one's going to show up for a while individually at your house. I mean, it's going to take some time. And I think a prioritization of, you know, what's the first level of triage would be helpful to have based on some of these things that are in the functions, because, you know, transportation, communications, public works, they all certainly tie into how do you distribute food and who, you know, do you go pick up elderly and disabled first, or, you know, can you hunker down in your house? And so I think that there's a lot of questions from the public about, you know, how does this roll out in an emergency? You know, what's a realistic timeline that someone's going to come to my home, and if I'm stuck, I don't have an answer for them. So that's, I'd like to sort of just see how we start to, underneath the response phases, prioritize those things so that we can communicate that back to constituents.
Chair Lively, Chair Brokquist, Representative Parrish, it's a good question, and it's a huge question. The coordination of managing or responding to a disaster, in Oregon, we like to speak about how it begins at the local level. The state is there to support the counties, and each county has some form of an emergency operations plans or how they will respond, and the state comes in to support those responses. At the state level, we do have, for a Cascadia subduction zone type event, what we call the Cascadia playbook. It's housed in Oregon Emergency Management, but all of the ORS council agencies participate in writing that, and there's a section for my work in ESF 6 and ESF 11. It does outline in some detail how the state would respond over the first 2 weeks, and then beyond that, within those individual emergency support functions, we do have to list our priorities or figure out what our priorities are. Quite honestly, in a large-scale disaster, the situational awareness that we have to gather and collect initially, and it's really, you know, we have to sustain life. And it's not a specific priority of which agency is going to do what, but we have to focus on how do we first sustain life, how do we rescue, go through the rescue operation, sustain life, and then how do we have that long-term recovery aspect. So I can work on getting something to you that's a little bit more detailed to help with that, and I would certainly appreciate any input from the committee on what that prioritization would look like in the weeds, so to speak, the granular level.
Senator Boquist, do you have a...
Most of us have the playbook.
Yeah.
Yes.
And to give you an example, I think of very close to what the good representative is saying, is just before the blackout dates, my email list is, I don't know, somewhere around 487,000 Oregonians, something like that. And I sent out an email outlining emergency preparedness, and you know, after the, you know, long enough after Cascadia to not to attribute it to our good federal colleagues, of the challenges that we're going to face that you've outlined, and trying to give individual citizens, you know, a guide of like, okay, it's not 72 hours, it's not 7 days, okay? If you're on the Oregon coast, you're talking 10 to 30 days, and you need to get prepared for this, and tried to outline some of the things that would happen. It's as Representative Parrish said, and as Representative Evans is going to jump in here in a minute because he's, you know, biting down there too, is the first is dismal because they don't believe it. I mean, it's interesting. I got a reply back that said you're a warmongering Republican XYZ, and this will never happen. And you know, my local responders are going to be there in 6 or 7 hours and save me, which is very intriguing because I thought, you know, okay, this is part of, you know, I guess, you know, natural selection or something, because if you don't prepare, you're not going to be there. And that's the thing we've got to get to, literally. And I think that's what Representative Parrish is saying. We need to start telling our people that we're not coming. I mean, and if you don't believe me, and you don't believe you, and you don't believe him, the deputy director of FEMA was at Cascadia, okay? And he outright told those of us who are here, I do believe, Representative Escobar, we're on our own, right? You're on your own. My plan is to take 5,000 of you and send you to every state in the union. That's my plan. And so we have a long ways to go to that. And, you know, I personally appreciate now that we have resilience, our coordinating stuff, because now I've heard two new agencies that I've never heard for before on this particular topic. And Sal, we've been at this how long?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Since I was in the House. Okay.
I think it's the follow-up for me is particularly since you said that number, you know, what was it, 6 and 11 were your priorities?
Yeah, emergency,
you know,
support
the,
function.
The food part, we have, you know, I mean, read the papers, one of the hungriest states in the nation. We have people who don't know what they're going to put on the table for dinner tonight, let alone have a two-week supply of food. And, you know, and every now and then I'm just, you know, in my own house putting my contacts in, and I was like, I'm out of contact lens solution. If there's an earthquake today, I'm blind as a bat, right? So how do we, I mean, I just don't know how to help my community really understand that this is serious, how we help build food resiliency specifically for low-income families who are not going to have a two-week supply because they're trying to figure out what's on the table today.
Chair Boquist and Representative Parrish, I'm going to maybe take my Department of Human Services hat off here for a second, and I'm going to put my Red Cross hat on because I'm also a Red Cross volunteer. And we work very, very hard as Red Cross volunteers. There are several programs within the Red Cross, and it is in the written testimony of preparedness classes, family preparedness classes, business preparedness classes, and the level of outreach that the Red Cross does and works very diligently to get that message across, because it's not going to be 72 hours. It's going to be a matter of a few weeks. The challenge, which is a very real challenge, is telling somebody you need a 2 weeks supply of food and they don't have enough for 24 hours. Working closely with the Oregon Food Bank in both capacities, in the Red Cross and the Department of Human Services, the Oregon Food Bank is working to establish caches of shelf-stable meals and food in areas that they think will be viable after a Cascadia subduction zone event. And that's something that is just beginning to be worked on, and it is in their testimony, that their written testimony that they provided. So it is convincing people that this is real. I run into them every day, and, you know, it's the Chicken Little, the sky is falling, and it's like, well, the sky will fall. And you need to do something about it personally. If we don't get Oregonians to understand their personal responsibility and that level of preparedness, it increases our challenges. When I teach the preparedness classes, I tell them it's for selfish reasons. The better prepared they are, the easier our work is at the government level. So we'll continue to work on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Boquist is right. We've talked about this forever in 6 months, it seems like. But
we were freshmen then.
Yeah, I think so. Been about 12 years ago. But we also need to get people to understand that this is real. And because you talk to people and they say, yeah, I know. Well, then you talk to them 2 months later and yeah, I know. Just talk about water. If you lose your infrastructure on water, what are you going to do? How are you going to process the water and make it so you can drink it? It shouldn't be 2 weeks. It should be more like 30 days or longer for preparedness of food, because my particular municipality has 80,000 people in it. How would we even react to that just that one city? You're talking 80,000 people that you'd have to come and take care of. The government will be overwhelmed. And we're not going to be able to be up for that occasion, because we certainly don't have 80,000 helicopters to jerk them out of there like the person on the coast thinks.
Is that supposed to make us feel better?
Yeah, I guess.
Chair Lively.
When I scared the hell out of my email, I got 1,000 responses. I had people that called up that would have never spoke to me in my life and said, hey, where can I get more information? I sent them to the Red Cross. I sent them to your webpage. I sent them all the bill. People, when you scare the crap out of them, they'll finally listen to you. But just representatives, I just want to point out that the esteemed upper chamber of the Senate, we have senators that don't believe it either. So it just tells you where we're at, okay?
Well, it's just the Senate, Senator.
I can find one of you 60. Mm-hmm.
I wholeheartedly agree.
Representative Evans.
Yeah, two things that I highly recommend for anybody who is watching in TV land, as well as to talk to folks in the local communities. Go to the FEMA webpage. ICS 100, ICS 200 are very free, very quick classes you can get on the FEMA webpage that any elected or appointed person who has not taken them, they're wrong. You need to take it to understand how the system works together. Second thing is the FEMA recovery framework is certainly not the most riveting reading available, but it does actually explain how the mechanics come through. Because at the end of the day, the system itself needs to be able to support the local on-scene commander that is making those types of decisions and priorities. And while, much like the colleagues talking about, I hope everybody is prepared, those that aren't may perish. The job of the folks running government at that point is to try to save the most people with the available resources we have. And again, at the local level, where people may actually listen to the mayor and the city councilor and those types of folks, those folks should be preparing themselves. ICS 100, 200, they're free, they're easy. If you haven't taken them, you're wrong.
Anything further? I might just say I was at a demonstration this summer about, when you talk about housing, and this was put on by some nursery friends of mine. They said, John, so why don't we use nursery buildings? And so they demonstrated to me how quickly they could assemble with the correct kind of plastic that protects from sun and would create living environments and places you could assemble within an hour's time spaces for hundreds of people in these temporary facilities, which they already do. That's what they use their nurseries for, but that's why they called me out there to demonstrate, said, here's something. It's not really expensive. You could station these things around. So to me, it was another concept just when we're talking about the masses and how we house them in a short time and gets around some of the issues of storing all these modular homes and things, because these are kits that would be located in a strategic case. So I thought that was I appreciated them taking the time to think about the issue in our area and about what they might do. So something to add to our considerations.
Certainly will.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
So, Jay, you have anything further to add?
Thank you, Chair Lively, Chair Boquist. In listening to the conversation, following up on what Stan said, that investments ahead of time have been demonstrated to be a huge savings from only spending money as a reactionary method, especially after the assets that you need have actually been broken. You basically sacrifice the loss of that facility. Waiting to fix it until it breaks is not a very good strategy for success.
No.
I had said yesterday when we were testifying at the House Healthcare that one of my concerns is in planning for mass displacement is unless we start getting our head around this here in Oregon and looking at what our specific needs are, mm-hmm. the likelihood is that the framework that Representative Evans mentioned from FEMA is going to be the plan that comes in as a default. And that it'll be much more of a national cookie cutter scale approach to our needs. That's probably not going to be tailored to what our best approaches would be. And it's really in our behalf to invest in understanding the problems and coming up with unique strategies that work for us. And having that plan in place when something happens that we can refer to. We may not be able to fix every problem, but having all of that identified in advance and having a pathway forward that we've worked on now is also just as critical. I think that planning doesn't have to be as cost intensive as a lot of the other infrastructure fixes, but organizationally, it's something you can't replace once the bad thing happens. So again, I'm urging for consideration for the planning for mass displacement now rather than waiting for another time to do it.
Thank you, Jane. Okay. Anything further? Okay, we'll move on. Thank you all for your patience for hanging around. So do we need to open a public hearing for this? Is that you open one?
Informational hearing, yeah. I don't really have quorum.
Yes, Mr. Chair, so you both.
Have quorum? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I open an informational hearing. That way somebody leaves.
Okay. Information. So we'll open the informational hearing on Measure 96.
It is a public hearing, Mr. Chair.
Public.
It's a public hearing. Yeah.
Public. Mm-hmm. It's a public hearing.
Right. We have witness lists. And
okay. Right. Then we'll open the public hearing for Measure 96 discussion. I just want to make a couple comments before we do. So these are policy committees. We're not Ways and Means. We're not the ones that ultimately make the budget decisions. Our goal is to recommend the great policies in that. In many cases, that brings the funding recommendations with it, but we don't make the final decisions regarding the budgets and what happens. The other thing I would just reinforce is we appreciate people's frustration with what the governor has recommended. That's her constitutional requirement to do what she did to make a recommended budget. There'll be other budgets that we'll talk about before we get there, and so that's just the way the system works. And so what I hope we can focus on today is how we could take the money, the total amount of money that's available, what our intent was to start with 96, and what are the things that we can do with that money that's going to best leverage and provide the services that we want. That'll give us then the opportunity from a policy standpoint to make sure we have the policies that support that, that will support why we need to spend the money in those places. So I'm hoping that's how where we can focus our conversations today. So shall we start with Cameron Smith?
Good afternoon, Chair Boquist, Chair Lively, members of the Joint Senate and House Veterans Committee. For the record, I'm Cameron Smith, the Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And on this snowy day, it warms my heart that we have a full house of veterans here to talk about our veterans' efforts for them, our military, and their families. And I have a very simple message of thanks. It is because of the veterans community's leadership here in this room and across Oregon, and all of you as legislative leaders, that we are at a critical turning point for our work for veterans, our military, and their families. When we had the unanimous and bipartisan legislative referral of House Joint Resolution 202 to the ballot this past November, having that become Measure 96, and with literally a very little yes campaign, very little no campaign, Oregonians simply opening up their ballot and looking at it, 84% of Oregonians stood up to say we need to better serve our veterans and their families. I don't believe there is any issue that the legislature deals with that we could ever get 84% of Oregonians to agree, and better serving our veterans is one of them. So just a hearty thank you, and this is a celebratory moment for the veterans community. Having that dedication, 1.5% of net lottery revenues embedded in the Constitution will begin to turn on July 1, is going to be transformational for our work, both to preserve the work that we're doing across broad partners and to make further investments. So it's an incredible opportunity. And it is certainly not about the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, how it was a legislative referral, why it was unanimous, why Oregonians stood up, because this work is much bigger than any one agency. And there's going to be plenty of time over the next 5 to 6 months to talk about our specific agency budget. But what we are excited about is those efforts at a statewide level through ODVA, but also those partnerships down to the county veteran service officers that you all know and love as a resource and as an advocate in the corner of your veterans and families, helping them navigate their benefits. Also, our connections with the national service organizations like the American Legion and VFW and others who are here today. And it's also those broader partnerships that we've never really truly invested in at a statewide level. Whether it's to better support student veterans on campus, whether it's to make better access to mental health resources for all veterans, or simply to prevent veterans' homelessness and more affordable housing for veterans. So all of these are in different policy option packages. They all are embedded in the governor's budget to both preserve what we're doing today and to extend further investments. I did pass along all of our efforts, these shared efforts. We have continually to hit. This is about veterans and their families thriving as individuals, as families, and as communities. But it is also about the economic impact of these veterans' benefits being drawn back to Oregon. The more veterans that we can identify, the more that we can get tied into their what are largely their federal VA earned benefits from their service, the more we can draw that federal tax dollar back to Oregon, which is a huge economic impact, not just for those dollars coming home, but then preserving that state general fund services at the local level. I've passed along a return on investment. We're calling that statewide veteran services effort an engine of economic development. We've heard the big numbers. We know Oklahoma, Oklahoma, roughly the same number of veterans. They've identified and service-connected an extra 20,000 more disabled veterans than Oregon. That works out to be $500 million in cash coming back to their Oklahoma veterans' pocketbooks and bank accounts. That would be, on a biennial basis, $1 billion more of those federal benefits just on disability compensation and low-income pensions coming back to Oregon veterans. We've heard those big numbers. We broke it down this time just on the per VSO, veteran service officer level. In that first year, once we've got a veteran service officer, whether it's with the national service orgs or the county or a statewide one, once they are trained and certified in submitting claims up to the federal VA on disability compensation, about 65% of their claims will be rated successfully. The per capita average now, $15,676 per disabled veteran, works out to be about $1.7 million impact that first year that a VSO is working. That rolls forward with inflation the next year, and it's a lifetime benefit as long as that disability is still impacting the veteran. Cumulatively, a VSO over 5 years helps draw down a measurable and conservative $27 million, all for the cost of their salary and benefits at a five-year level, about $400,000. There is no way that we can get a greater return on our investment, and it is for this incredible population of veterans that we're honored to serve. And again, that's just the disability compensation, not the health care benefits, not the educational GI and GI Bill and vocational rehab benefits, much less how we link them to community resources and preserve those state general fund dollars or county general fund dollars. And honestly, I want to, again, relay my thanks, but also I'm happy to take questions either now or at the end, but I would also like to yield my time to the veteran community leaders who were so instrumental, along with you, bringing us to this point so we can hear their voices.
Representative Parrish.
Well, thank you, Cameron. I appreciate it, and I appreciate this document because I think it's important to see that the work that everyone's doing to make that impact. And obviously, we're all sitting here and got an email from somebody who is still struggling after 20 years to get through the VA. So we know that there is, you know, work to do. So I appreciate this. What is missing from this? And I would really like to see by the end of the session, and I don't know who we get it from. I've sort of asked our people before, but when we get a part of Mark's compensation comes in as disability compensation, it is tax-free, and we spend it, right? I go to the grocery store and I spend it. What is missing from this equation that I don't think maybe some of our other colleagues in this body understand is that while that compensation is tax-free, and the second and third economic tier of that there is money coming back to the general fund. So while people, you know, a $10 million potential cut out of the budget, how much money of these dollars coming back is actually fueling into the general fund through income taxes when this money is being spent in the economy? And I feel like that's the missing piece of this equation as we think about how we're going to fund veteran services, is that it's not just that money's being spent in our economy, money's coming back to this body to spend on other things from these dollars. And I think we have got to solve that equation before the end of this budget cycle when we vote or not vote on a veteran's budget. So I would like to somehow chase that down, and I don't know how we get there.
Mr. Chair, as Representative Parrish, we would agree with you wholeheartedly. Simply the spending, the multiplier effect, some of the testimony you'll hear today, it's simply that, it's being spent in the grocery stores, gas stations, in our community, that economic ripple. And eventually, through that, it's circulating back into the state coffers as well on a number of different avenues. And we will be happy to tee up that presentation and get this conversation going across House and Senate Revenue Committee as much as our economic development ones.
The fault, real quick, somewhere, if we don't have a way to generate that figure, somebody has that access to that figure, because this is the big fight when, you know, we're going to close down Fort Sill and some congressman in Oklahoma is all upset because they can reverse engineer this, right? If you close a base and that money leaves your community, right? That's why, like, Congress people with bases go crazy when we talk about shutdowns, because they know there is a multiplier effect. So somewhere that data or that factor exists, and I don't think we have to go recreate the wheel.
Correct.
So if we can get that before we vote on a budget, that's the one thing I would really like to see out of your office.
Will do.
Representative Esquivel.
Representative, when I was on the president of Southern Oregon Regional Economic Development, we felt for every dollar that was brought in, it was $3.84.
To the general fund for taxes?
No, to the economy. Just the economy alone, not taxes, but just the economy alone.
I'm interested in the tax factor. Oh. I'm interested that if, you know, if I take our compensation, Mark's compensation, and go to Safeway with it, and Safeway pays some kind of corporation tax, we can have that discussion, or but they're paying employment tax, and they're and the employees are being paid, and they're paying income tax, there is a multiplier effect, though, that goes into that. That's the piece I want, because for every dollar we put in, how much money is being circulated back to our general fund that is being spent in education and housing and human services and everything else that we care about? And it's a lot of money. I just don't know what it is.
And Mr. Chair, as Representative Parrish, we'll certainly do our best effort. And there are, it's not, we don't have to recreate wheels entirely. But even a broader study through someone like Econ Northwest, we've seen this for what's the impact of tourism? What's the impact? It is. You know, whether you're looking at military retirements coming back, whether you're looking at the payrolls of the federal VA staff, it is a significant, the much broader, it just, these numbers are big as is, and it just keeps getting even, I mean, it is win after win after win for Oregon to do this work.
I just
think
veterans are paying for themselves, so.
Representative Evans.
Yes, Director Smith, thank you very much for the presentation. I look forward to lots of conversations over the year. My question is very simple. What was the total ask of the POPs that you submitted into the process, not how much was funded, but what was the total ask of the POPs that you submitted into the process?
Mr. Chairs, Representative Parrish, for our agency request budget, so there was not a cap this year on what agencies could request. We submitted as a small agency back in August 1st. Off of a lot of outreach and networking across the veterans community, was about 16 million in new ideas. At that point, phrased as general fund asks, since it was in advance of the lottery funding, many of those policy option packages that were pitched as general fund then became embedded in the governor's budget with lottery funding. But about 16 million in new ideas. We didn't request up to the full 18 million plus that was expected off of the lottery dedication. To be able to set some of those lottery dollars aside as reserve in a working capital account, similar to what Parks and Rec and other lottery-funded agencies have done.
And that doesn't include the Incarcerated Veterans Task Force recommendations or some of the other work that's in the process. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, is Representative Evans correct? That report, I believe, came out in September, so it was a little bit after agency request budget.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Director. So we will maybe, if there's questions after everybody else is testifying.
Happy to come back up.
Thank you. So I'm just going to call, I'll call three people at a time in the order here in which I have people signed up. So Wayne Harvey, Jim Willis, and Ken Kraft. Just please introduce yourself for the record. And again, thank you for your patience. Your service, that's right.
Jim Willis has lots of patience.
Chair Boyquist,
deal with us. He had to have patience.
Lots of patience.
Chair Boyquist, Chair Lively, members of the committee, fellow veterans, and distinguished guests. For the record, my name is Wayne Harvey. I am the current chairman of the United Veterans Groups of Oregon, the UVGO, and the current president of the Retired Enlisted Association chapter here in Oregon. UVGO is made up of military veterans from 10 different veterans organizations: the Air Force Association, the American Legion, AMVETS, the Disabled American Veterans, the Korean War Veterans Association, the Military Officers Association of America, the Military Order of the Purple Heart, the Paralyzed Veterans of America, the Retired Enlisted Association, and the Vietnam Veterans of America. We come together to present a unified position on matters concerning the welfare of Oregon's 330,000 veterans and their dependents and survivors. With your critical help this year, the Oregon voters were given the chance to step up and to help our veterans. As you know, ballot measure 96 passed by an extremely large majority. The voters clearly realized that our state was not directing enough money to veterans' issues. The voters therefore agreed on a plan to increase what our state was spending on veterans' issues with the 1.5% of lottery dollars. It is our belief that ballot measure 96 revenue was never meant to substitute general funds going into ODVA. In our view, these new monies were meant to supplement the ODVA budget so they could expand their services, tackle new veterans issues, as well as possibly be used for other veterans issues outside of ODVA. This was the message we conveyed to our organizations and to their members. The result of the vote showed us that Oregonians agreed that we in Oregon needed to do more for our veterans rather than just maintaining the current level of service. Most would agree that the needs of the veterans community are vast and complicated. We hope to work with this committee and your fellow legislators in the coming months to find the best ways to use the 1.5% of the lottery to best support the veterans. On behalf of the members of the UVGO member organizations, my fellow military retirees, other veterans and families, I come before you today to go on the record asking you to work with your colleagues in the Senate and the House to develop a fair budget that will allow ODVA to maintain their current level of service without relying on the use of lottery monies to sustain them. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Boquist, Chair Lively, my name is Ken Kraft. I'm the Senior Vice Commander for the Veterans of Foreign Wars Department of Oregon, United States of America, and the Vice Chairman for the Western Conference. It's a pleasure to be here today, and I start off thanking each and every one of you and the members who are not here for letting the voters have the opportunity in November. I'd like to thank the time for considering the following written testimony concerning the Veterans of Foreign Wars families and funding services in Oregon. It's our sincerest hope this testimony will provide you with helpful information in your efforts to determine and develop policy and law. Governor's budget. Veterans of Foreign Wars in the United States has a long and proud history working with all veterans. We are the largest combat veteran service organization in the United States of America, chartered by Congress, comprised of veterans who have served in every overseas conflict since the Spanish-American War. While our membership consists of combat veterans, our mission and our greatest passion is serving all veterans, service members, and their families. On December 1st, 2016, Governor Brown's proposed budget for the 2017 to 2019 biennium was released. We were very disappointed to read the proposal to cut 80% from the general fund for veteran services. That is nearly $10 million. We believe the Oregon has a general fund responsibility to our veterans. When the Oregon voters passed Measure 96 by 84%, the largest margin of any measure in the history of our great state, they did so with the understanding that 1.5% of lottery funds would be a supplement to the current service level from the general fund, not a substitute of those funds. On November 8, 2016, the voters overwhelmingly spoke in support of significant increases to the veteran service budget for current and future years. The Department of Oregon, Veterans of Foreign Wars, the United States, understands there are many factors and problems in balancing the budget and ensuring that all Oregonians are represented. In those deliberations, consider the Veterans of Foreign Wars and other veteran service organizations when we ask you to continue the state's responsibility to veterans from the general fund at the current level and to supplement veteran services from the Measure 96 lottery funds. In doing so, you're not only honored and benefit families, you also honor the wishes of the Oregon voter as well and benefit the economy. Background. Department of Oregon, Veterans of Foreign Wars in the United States has been dedicated to providing veteran service office serving all Oregons for over 70 years. The Department of Oregon, Veteran Service Office operates in the VA regional office under the administrative supervision of the department commander and under the technical supervision of the Veterans of Foreign Wars National Service Office. Over the years, as the VA system has become more complex and demand for veteran services has increased, our resources have declined. We need your help to assist our comrades. Our situation is summarized below. Facts. VFW service officers have routinely handed out twice the number of claims, 480 is average, 180 for service officers statewide. VFW service office has routinely obtained 20 to 35 million in annual VA payments to veterans in earned benefits, 1.5 to 2 service officers. VFW service officers have been compensated at about 50% of the rate paid to the average VSO in the state. Low compensation levels have made it difficult to hire and retain qualified personnel. Training for VFW service officers provided by the VFW National Office is considered among the best in the nation. Heavy workload with minimal staffing has caused the service to individual veterans to be below desired standards. Annual funds available from the Veterans of Foreign Wars is limited to $50,000 plus $13,800 for the state of Oregon through ODVA. Department of Oregon Veterans Foreign Wars provides funding to the VFW VA Volunteer Service representatives at VA medical facilities in Portland, Roseburg, and White City to purchase comfort items for patients, $150 per month to each, total annual expense of $5,400. The cost is part of our service officer budget. Assumptions. Staffing level of the Oregon of Department of Oregon Veterans Foreign Wars Office needs to be increased to 4 service officers and 1 administrative position to provide the expected level of service to the veterans requesting service from this office. In order to hire and retain qualified service officers to meet the required staffing levels, compensation must be increased to levels closer to that paid service officers throughout our state. The 4th service officer will be primarily used for outreach to the 80-plus posts in 14 districts around the state. Allows the Department of Oregon to leverage the 95-plus volunteer post and district service officers. Travel rates paid for outreach work will be at the GSA per diem rates and mileage at IRS rate. Proposal. The Department of Oregon Veterans Foreign Wars in the United States request $278,172 per year in lottery funds to provide veteran service officers. Department of Oregon Veterans of Foreign Wars Service Office staffing level will be 1 service officer, 3 assistant service officers, and 1 admin position. Compensation and benefits will be: A. Service officer, $66,110. B. Assistant service officer, $61,162. C. Admin, $39,226. And estate travel for outreach, $40,750, 2,000 plus miles per month, 16 days per month. Office expense, $7,000 plus 5,400 VAVs, $12,400. Total service office budget, $341,972 plus VFW National provided training and assurance. Available funding, $63,800. Advantages of the VFW service officers. Clearly, there is a large population of veterans that prefer the VFW service officer, in part due to our 16,000 members and over 6,000 auxiliary, which is a total of 20,000 members statewide. VFW service officers have and will continue to work at less than average compensation level for service officers statewide. The VFW service officers have a record of higher productivity than the average service officer, with over 200 of earned benefits obtained for veterans for each dollar invested. Training and technical oversight provided by National VFW is the best available. The 95-plus volunteer post and district service officers can be leveraged with competent, accredited department service officers. Conclusion. Providing the quest funding of $278,122 will meet the very purpose of Measure 96 by providing competent veteran services in an efficient manner to a large population of veterans that prefer to be represented by a VFW service officer. It is expected that the $278,000 annual investment will generate an additional $28 million in earned benefits to the veterans served by the VFW service office. Just as important as the monetary return is the increased quality of service that will be provided to the veteran serves. Thank you for all the hard work and dedication to veterans and the families of the state of Oregon.
Thank you for the detail. Well done.
Chair Lively, Chair Boquist, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, and professional staff. For the record, my name is Jim Willis. I am currently the department commander for the American Legion, or in other words, the state commander. I share many of the same concerns that were just voiced by my colleague from the Veteran of Foreign Wars. So I will be brief. Let me say quite simply that when we kicked off the campaign to pass Measure 96, right here at the Capitol, right at the Oregon World War II Memorial, we agreed that we would fan out across the state and make the provisions of Measure 96 clear to both the veteran and non-veteran community in our state. That is exactly what we did through media, including newspapers, radio, and television, and then personal appearances. When I can only speak for myself in terms of my appearances, and that was that I represented to both veteran and non-veteran alike that the provisions of Measure 96 would result in supplemental program funding for the veterans, their families, and their dependents, and their survivors in our state. You can imagine my surprise when the governor's budget was published and I found that the 2015-17 ODVA budget of over $13 million had been reduced for 2017-19 to $3,300,000. What a betrayal. What should have been a shot in the arm for Oregon's veterans turned out to be a knife in the back. And I say that strongly and clearly because that is what I'm hearing from the veteran community. I also tell you that because this is not what I told citizens was going to happen. And when I give my word about something, I take it very seriously. And I felt violated, and I still do to this day. So, let me say to the committee, both committees, it is my fervent hope that even though the executive branch had the legal authority to do this, there was a moral imperative involved here that was violated. They didn't morally have the right to do this. And so I seek restoration to current service level for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs budget, and I seek a continuing conversation for how we should best use these supplemental funds totaling nearly $18 million over the next biennium. I appreciate very much Representative Lively wanting to talk in specifics. I think we're early in that process, but I will give you two examples very quickly.
Thank you.
One is ODVA has had a state education program for many years that has been woefully underfunded because here's what happens. Senior veterans change careers, their job is eliminated, and then they say, okay, the thing for me to do is go back to school, either for academic education or for trade school. The only place they have to turn to then is the Oregon Veteran Education Fund because they're no longer qualified for the GI Bill. That fund has been underfunded. This could be an answer for that in the future. Second issue, emergency assistance. Some time ago, and when I was still serving as the Director of Veterans Affairs, we had tremendous flooding in this state. Fortunately, and through the auspices of this body, you folks gave us an emergency assistance fund. We had those funds in our budget. We were able to respond to that area where the flooding was occurring and take care of veterans and their families through the use of those emergency funds, which allowed them not to draw down on the other emergency funds that were being used by the state. So we saved the state money in that regard. And then the very best part of this is, because I had had some background with Oregon Emergency Management, I was well aware that we could seek 75% return on our investment from FEMA, and that's exactly what happened, and they gave us a check, which allowed us to recover 75% of our state emergency funds for veterans assistance that we used during that time. So I would hope, as an example, just in those two areas, emergency assistance for veteran families and the educational funding, that we could look at sustaining that as perhaps part of this nearly $18 million in lottery funding. I appreciate the opportunity on behalf of the American Legion and serving as a legislative liaison from the UVGO to have a chance to speak to the committee here today and see some old friends and some new ones. I nearly called one of the committee members chief when, in fact, she is a state representative. So I apologize to the chief for that.
She's still the chief.
Thank you very much, Chair Lively and Chair Boquist, for the opportunity to speak to you here.
Thank you very much.
This is a question for Ken. You gave us a really detailed budget analysis, and one of the pieces of the language in the bill, and when we crafted it first 4 years ago, we were really trying to get to tribal and nonprofit organizations who could deliver these services maybe at a different cost structure than what we have when we hire a county VSO or somebody who's sort of fully loaded pensions and costs and the reality of, you know, having FTE. And so what would be helpful for me for the VFW would definitely be to get all of your history of, you know, kind of what you just provided. I know you gave this written testimony, but I'd actually like to see what you project your outcomes would be and how you would tackle sort of the outreach piece of that to be able to ramp up, because I liked your numbers and would like to be able to, you know, consider all of those as options. But we do know there's a whole population of veterans who just doesn't want to come into the VA for whatever reason, and you're their first line of defense. And that was one of the reasons why nonprofits language was in there, because we know we need to have other avenues for people to reach out to. So I'd like to see an actual, like, really concrete marketing, like a business plan around how you would take those funds and ramp them up to scale and, you know, really dive in and make that investment.
Chair Buckwist, Chair Lively, Representative Parrish, we will provide information.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, we have some people on this committees and Senate and the House that have been around the block a couple of times here, and I have yet to see a governor's budget that we ever adopted. It's a starting point, and that thing will be massaged, I'm sure. Actually, this thing will boil down to two different arenas. It's going to be the subcommittee, and then it's going to be full Ways and Means. That's where the fight will be. There's not really much we can say, because, I mean, it's prerogative of the governor. She could put down zero. It would have been okay, because it's the law. It's okay. But, you know, the fight will be in the subcommittee especially, so I can't emphasize that. But trust me, I kind of laughingly call the governor's budget, and it doesn't matter whose budget it is, because I've been through several governors, that it's kind of the fantasy part of the process up here, because it's never adhered to.
Okay. Thank you, all three of you.
Sure.
Again, for your patience and good testimony. So we have Dennis Guthrie, Stephen Baxter, and Alan Barker.
Chairman Boquist and Chairman Lively, for the sake of time, most of what I was going to say has already been said. So I will bow out and allow these others to continue on.
Thank you very much.
Just for the sake of time.
Right? Sure. We appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you.
I've got to go back over the hill.
Okay. That's understandable.
Chair Lively, Chair Boquist, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. For the record, my name is Stephen Baxter. I'm the president of the Willamette chapter of the Military Officers Association of America. The Military Officers Association of America, or MOAA, is the nation's largest and most influential association of military officers. It is an independent, nonprofit, politically nonpartisan organization with about 355,000 members from every branch of the service, including active duty, National Guard, Reserve, retired, former officers, and their families. We are a powerful force speaking for a strong national defense and representing the interests of military officers at every stage in their careers, to include post-military service. The Oregon State Council of MOAA represents 9 chapters across the state. I'm here representing them on behalf of Brigadier General Merrill, who lives in Bend and wasn't able to get here today. These chapters here in Oregon are involved in many activities that foster support for the military and encourage stronger relationships between the services and civilian communities. These activities include supporting junior ROTC and ROTC units, supporting our deployed troops and their families, as well as recognition in honor for service veterans from past conflicts. Additionally, our chapters provide grassroots support for veterans and military legislative initiatives and assistance for a variety of veterans-related programs and initiatives. The Oregon Council of Chapters views recent voter approval of Measure 96 as a positive event and fully supports the intended purpose of this historic legislation. Fully dedicating 1.5% of state lottery proceeds is the right decision in support of Oregon veterans and keeps faith with the more than 1.6 million Oregonians who voted to approve Measure 96. We do not support the governor's proposed budget, specifically as it relates to the substitution of general fund monies with lottery funds for the Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs. We strongly believe this runs counter to the intent and spirit of Measure 96. Funds resulting from passage of Measure 96 must be properly allocated and supplement, not substitute, general fund monies as originally intended and approved by voters. Oregon veterans can realize significant and meaningful gains resulting from the overwhelming approval of Measure 96. Apportionment of the monies that will become available must be holistically applied across all of our state's veterans in a manner to address the most critical needs of all. Thank you very much for this opportunity and time to speak with all of you. Chairman Lively, Chairman Boquist, thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Boquist and Chairman Lively, Vice Chairman and committee members, my name is Alan Barker and I live in Kaiser. I appreciate the opportunity to share my thoughts today. Many of the things that I wish to have already discussed are going to be discussed by people a lot more professional than myself. You know, this is one of those opportunities where we can actually support spending to different agencies within our state that actually nets the state of Oregon a heck of a lot more than we spend. I think that Dan Crow is going to be up here shortly, and he's going to give you some benchmarks of what he's seen. But I can tell you that I can attest to you that as an example of some of the dollars that are spent on programs to recover the resources or recover the funds at the federal level can reap great rewards. You already know this has happened, but to give you an example, I can, and many of you may already know this, in 2010, the state of California actually received 32% of federal funds for programs such as what we're looking at right here. 32% of all federal funds. And yet the state of California only had 12% of the population of the United States. I submit to you that that's because the state of California spends a lot more money supporting departments and committees, commissions, and agencies that go after that funding to help those folks that need the funds gather them. So in support of that concept today, I appreciate my time that I've been able to spend with you, and I yield the balance of my time.
Thank you. Thank you very much, both of you, for your patience in being here. So we have Ron Morgan, Daniel Crow, and Ryan Fisher, but did Ryan...
I think Ryan disappeared.
I think Ryan left.
He's a Portlandia guy. You know?
Yeah.
He didn't want to sleep in the halls of the Capitol like an airport.
I'll love it.
Welcome. Just please introduce yourself for the record.
I'm Ron Morgan. I'm the president of the VBA, Oregon State Council, as Vietnam Veterans of America. I'm also on the National Board of Directors for the VBA. And I know we've worked very hard throughout this entire episode of getting Measure 96 through. And I appreciate the hard work everybody on this committee has done, both committees, that that's been outstanding, and we really thank you for your support. I would like to say that the Vietnam veterans, we started in 1978, and basically it was because we weren't really accepted in any of the other service organizations. And we adopted the principle that never again will one generation of veterans be abandoned by another. And so we fight for all the veterans today, past, present, and future. And one of the things that we appreciate here in Oregon is the support from the legislature. And we need individuals to stand up and work for these disabled veterans who may not want to go to the VA willingly because they don't trust the government, but they will approach a service officer. We have several of them here in Oregon, and all of them are underfunded. Two of our best are in Eugene and over in Redmond. And one of them has been working as a service officer since 1978. And he would ask that Measure 96 would provide him with a little bit of assistance, not a whole lot. He's not asking for much, but a few thousand dollars just to help him meet his expenses. Most of what he, most of his income is, you know, what he spends is personal income, and it's totally volunteer on his part. And he represents all kinds of veterans, not just new veterans coming in looking for assistance in filing their disability claims, but those who have had their claims refused. And he's a retired attorney, and he takes their cases, and when they go to the courts, many times it's settled out of court because the opposition doesn't even want to fight with him because he's so darn successful at everything he brings in. And so he's got a track record of winning hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars for veterans. And we need people like that. And we're only going to be able to keep those kind of people if we can help to fund them and make it easier for them to survive as service officers. We need more service officers. The VVA has about a half a dozen of them in the state. And most of them are working, are paying the bills out of their own pockets. They get very little support from anybody. So I'd like to think that what we've been telling the public, what we've been telling other service agency organizations, is that Measure 96 will provide funding above and beyond what the general fund would be for ODVA, and that these are supplemental funds that will help our veterans and their families. And the families suffer just as much as the veterans do. So most of what I had intended to say has already been said. So at this point, Chairman Lively and Senator Boquist and Vice Chairs, I'd like to yield my time to Dan.
Thank you again very much.
Chairman Boquist, Chairman Lively, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Daniel Crow. Thank you so much for having us here today to talk about these matters. I know that to a certain extent we are preaching to the choir because all of you have been consistent allies and friends of the veteran community in Oregon. And so the first and most important thing that we want to reiterate is thank you all very much for your leadership and your dedication to our veterans and our veteran families, which are just as important as our veterans themselves. I wear a lot of hats. I'm not wearing my VFW or my American Legion hat today. I think they look silly, but nevertheless, I do have them somewhere. But I am all things legal with respect to veterans advocacy here in Oregon. So on behalf of the Military and Veterans Law Section of the Oregon State Bar, of which I'm the chair, the Oregon Veterans Legal Services, which has created the first veterans legal clinic here in Oregon at Willamette, and of the Veterans Justice Project, which administers the legal portion of the Supportive Services for Veterans Families program here in Oregon, I'm speaking in that capacity today. But what I want to share with the board is you've already heard multiple witnesses testify about the moral imperative, which we are all well aware of, supporting our veterans. But there are lots and lots of sympathetic destinations for Oregonians' tax dollars. And so one of the things I wanted to share with all the members of both committees today are some more nuts and bolts, some fiscal considerations, including addressing Representative Parrish's question about the estimation of the amount of money that $10 million actually puts in the pockets of the Oregon government every year. As we build out our ability to care for our veterans better, all the members of the legislature, all members of Oregon government have heard loud and clear the results of this election. And 1.63 million Oregonians voted for Measure 96. So if every single Oregon veteran voted, that only accounts for about 330,000 votes. So for some reason, 1.3 million Oregonians who aren't veterans voted for this as well. And I believe it's because they are sensible of the value add of taking care of veterans and the ability to avoid excess costs. So with respect to the policy considerations, the two things that we wanted to deliver to you today are, first of all, some thoughts, our thoughts from the legal perspective about policy considerations as we're building out the policy options, plans, and building out various capabilities that we're going to be adding to the way in which we care for Oregon veterans, and then also some numbers. So those are the two things that we're going to leave you with today. What we envision from a more global perspective is implementing something that's worked very well in the Supportive Services for Veterans Families program. So for those of you who are unfamiliar, I'm not going to read all 18 pages of my testimony, but the Supportive Services for Veterans, you're welcome. The Supportive Services for Veterans Families program is actually invisible from the numbers that we're tracking with respect to veterans spending from the VA down, because it's not accounted for in the VA's numbers that are coming down into Oregon for compensation and pensions, medical care, et cetera, et cetera. But as our testimony makes clear, we spend more than the federal government, the VA spends more than $10 million per year funding the Supportive Services for Veterans Families program here in Oregon in 34 of our 36 counties. And the way that we do that, speaking to one of the issues that Representative Parrish talked about earlier, and the intention of getting money down to nonprofits. Well, the Supportive Services for Veterans Families program has blazed that trail already, because what they do is they take money to nonprofits that are already helping veterans, and the federal government gives money to those nonprofits to help them help veterans more effectively. So Transition Projects manages the largest of the 8 SSVF grants here in the state of Oregon, up in the Portland metro area, but we have a community action team up at St. Helens. We have Mid-Willamette Valley Community Action Agency here in Marion and Polk counties, St. Vincent de Paul down in Eugene, Access down in Medford, Central Oregon Veterans Outreach, and then CAPO, which covers all of the kind of residual counties in the state that add up to 34 of our 36 counties. We spend $10 million a year addressing the needs of homeless veterans, and it's money well spent. And the results that we've been able to obtain in reducing veteran homelessness have been amazing. Just as importantly, Oregon has taken a position as being a leader in the entire country in the manner in which we care for our veterans and the effectiveness with which we care for our veterans. Unfortunately, my colleague Alex Glover, who runs the Supportive Services for Veterans Families grant in the Portland metro area for Transition Projects, wasn't able to be here today, but that's $3.4 million by itself every year. The Downside of that is that $6 million of that $10 million is sunsetting. That federal money is sunsetting. Most of it at the end of this fiscal year, September 30th of 2017, the federal fiscal year, and then the last $2 million of it. So four of that six is going to sunset, and then the last $2 million of it is going to sunset in September 30th, 2018. So the money is going away, which is causing all these nonprofits to scramble right now to identify ways in which they can continue and sustain doing all the good things that we're doing. So the section B of the testimony that we've provided for you is some examples of the efficacy and usefulness of legal services within the context of veterans services, and also we've shared a little bit about the SSVF program itself for your reading enjoyment. To answer Representative Parrish's question, at least to give us a good estimate, which we'll follow up on and get you something more in writing, and we're going to make sure that every representative and every senator gets a copy of this, as well as how much VA money is going into each one of their districts in each of the counties in your respective districts, because it's in our written testimony, and it is sizable. In fact, Senator Boquist's district gets more than $500 million in federal money coming into the counties. Now, that isn't since your district doesn't include all of every county. It's not 100%, but certainly those counties are getting a sizable amount of money, and we've broken that down both for every member of the committee, the counties in which each of you serve, and we're going to intend to do that to every member of the legislature. So $10 million, ODVA estimates that for every dollar we spend on veteran service officers, we get about $77 of additional veterans benefits, because they are able to navigate through an otherwise very, very unfriendly system in the Veterans Benefit Administration at the federal level. So cutting $10 million means losing $770 million worth of federal benefits, if ODVA's estimates are correct, and I think that they're actually conservative. Representative Esquivel talked earlier about the economic multiplier effect. They use 3.78 down in Southern Oregon, a conservative number that we've seen used in the past, and that's common amongst economists, is about 5. So $770 million coming into Oregon represents $3.85 billion of economic activity in Oregon, $3.85 billion. We're not going to capture all 8% of that economic activity, happily. The tax man isn't going to capture that. But even if we only capture half of that in Oregon taxes, that's $154 million in tax revenue that cutting $10 million out of the veteran service budget results in. And the number one the group of facts that we wanted to leave with every member of this committee so that you can go evangelize amongst your colleagues is that there is a box with about $4 billion sitting in it that is here in Oregon. And that box is unclaimed veterans benefits. We claim about $2.5 billion in veterans benefits. We could claim a lot more. And I'll share with you numbers to compare apples to apples in a moment. But the testimony that we heard earlier about the fact that California punches way above its weight needs to be counterbalanced by the fact that states like Oregon punch way below our weight. So we will have plenty of time in the fullness of the budgeting process in front of the Ways and Means Committees and the subcommittees in arguing about where that money is going to end up at the end of the day. What we want each member of these committees to take away from today is that we could spend up to $51 million more per year and not run out of additional federal benefits. So that $51 million is the key that can unlock $4 billion of additional federal benefits. Economic multiplier rule, $20 billion of Oregon economic activity, because for those of you who know service members, when service members get money in their pockets, they tend not to put it in the bank or bury it somewhere. They tend to spend it. So we're talking about substantial lost revenue. So just to compare apples to apples, we talked earlier about Oklahoma. Oklahoma generates about $500 million more per year in veterans' benefits, including compensation and pension medical care. There's no reason in the world to believe that Oklahoman veterans get blown up at any higher rate than Oregon veterans do, and yet they generate about $500 million more per year of money, cash, flowing into the state of Oklahoma, which I would suggest is a good thing for Oklahoma and not a great thing for Oregon. So to compare apples to apples, we spend about $9 million per year in veterans' services. Oklahoma spends about $35 million a year in veterans' services. Now, granted, that only represents a multiplier of $23 million for every extra million that they spend, but that's still a lot of money, and it's still something that we would urge the committee to consider and to use as a benchmark for why spending additional money is good for everyone, because expanding that pie is an inherently good thing from our perspective. It benefits all Oregonians, which is why I would suggest those 1.3 million other Oregonians were inclined to support this, because this is one of those rare cases when the moral case and the fiscal case are aligned. The other thing that we would like to leave with the committee is the value that we've established within the Supportive Services for Veterans Families Program in holistic management of veterans advocacy, and to encourage the committee as it is building the policy which is going to govern the way in which we care for our veterans and veteran families over the next biennium, that holistic management is the way of the future. It is a model which we have had the opportunity to go out and teach throughout the rest of the country in the way in which you manage veterans and any challenged population, but particularly veterans and veteran families, and that what we've encouraged in Part B of our testimony, of our written testimony, is adoption of the Oregon Veterans Care Plan, which is an holistic mechanism that where we acquire those veterans upon ETS, and we manage them through their entire quote-unquote life cycle, which in this case is kind of literal, and that we pick them up as soon as they end their term of service in the military, and we have care for them all the way from there through their veterans benefit claim process, through putting them into one of our veterans' homes, all the way towards giving them a dignified and appropriate burial in one of our national cemeteries or in whatever cemetery they want to be buried in. This type of management of veterans both allows us to care for our veterans appropriately and comprehensively and holistically, because a veteran very rarely presents with one problem, which is discrete and isolated from all the problems. So first of all, it allows us to take care of them in the most compassionate, suitable, and morally appropriate way. And, oh, by the way, it also allows us to maximize the amount of federal benefits that those veterans receive, which then flows back into our society to the benefit of all Oregonians. And so with that, I think that touches on the highlights of the testimony that we wanted to share with you today, and hopefully builds a bit of the fiscal case that we will continue building between now and the 9th of July. We want to thank all of you again for all the work that you did and for all of your leadership. It is you who carry the seed of care and knowledge about the needs of our veterans and the opportunities that are before us right now to the rest of your colleagues. And I think that has already borne great fruit, and it will bear even more fruit as we go forward through this biennia and into the future. We're showing the rest of the country. We are on the verge of showing the rest of the country what right looks like with respect to caring for veterans. And I'm excited to be part of that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So that's the list I have. Do we have a second list?
No, Chair Lively, but I did want to draw the members' attention to some testimony that's received from people who couldn't be here or were not able appear, including Ren Lino, the tribal chair for the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde, who's also a member of the ODVA Advisory Committee, and also let you know that Ryan stayed as long as he could, Mr. Fisher. He was here on behalf of a couple of community action groups, which is multiple counties, generally emphasizing the importance of local veteran service officers. But there's additional testimony as well for folks who
could
be here.
I would like to direct Cameron back here for a moment.
I think he was saying he would be willing to do that.
I don't care whether he's willing or not.
I knew you didn't. So.
Can I ask a quick question for Cheyenne, actually? Because my laptop died and I don't have the cord. Did AOC at all submit their kind of?
I noticed yours.
The Association of Oregon Counties did a kind of a whereas resolution.
He's in the back.
He's in the back.
He's in the back.
Chair Lively, Chair Boquist, Representative Parrish, Andy Smith is in the room, can speak to that. I believe we received it, and they were working on a resolution.
I got a copy of it. That's great.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm Cameron Smith, Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And what I appreciate is that the testimony here today is not just from the veterans community. They are our partners in charge. They are on our advisory committee. We partner with them throughout the year. And I want to second Representative Esquivel's comments that this the governor's budget is a starting point always. Agency request budget does not become wholeheartedly adopted. Governor's budget certainly doesn't at all either. And it is that collaborative conversation across the next 6 months that gets us to a great starting, to gets us to a great effort for Oregon veterans. And I am entirely grateful and just want to be clear, everything we are doing today for veterans through ODVA's budget is rolled forward in the governor's budget. What we're talking about is that how much is new of these lottery dollars, how much is preserving what we are doing today, and how much is new. That's the central decision that the legislature will be grappling with. And it is a challenging budget for you all to take across key areas of human services, health, education, safety. There are a lot of cuts in the governor's recommended budget. And what we are talking about is the depth of investment, because this is a shining light in what is a not a great budget for many state agencies and partners. But happy to take any other questions.
Andy, would you come up here too, please? Director, because I mean, this is going to set the stage going forward, and I'm looking across. I don't think anybody on here is on Ways and Means. I don't think there's a single budget crunch right here. Director, my question is really pretty simple, and that is you know, just roughly off the top of your head, how much money goes into your budget today, right? Presently, this fiscal biennium, you can pick it per year or every 2 years. For veteran service officers, either directly yours or in his good counties?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, our total budget is operational, about $92 million. Right. That general funded portion in the 15-17 current biennium is just over $10 million, half of which flows down to the counties and national service organizations. That's a biennial number, so about $2.5 million a year to run both that statewide operation and that local operation.
Sal, when you and I started out with Donna Nelson, we had about not even a million. So we pushed that up to about $2.5 million a year.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it was the surge in 2005-2007 at the height of Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts. It used to be simply a $10,000 per county contribution down to that veteran service office level. And this is something, this is a system that has been in existence since 1945. The counties are stepping up since then. And literally since that 2005 biennium, there's been a more significant state contribution to add to that very local support from the county level.
Andy, I read the resolution, which, if I believe, is out of the boilerplate presentation from the dear director, if you're right, which is the basic numbers of how much money we have gained in-state gains in healthcare and non-healthcare financing from the federal government to our veterans. 10 minutes. $1.4 billion since we increased it from under a million to 2.5 million. So for basically $1.5 million, we have generated $1.4 billion more per year. $1.4 billion per year. Half of that, Andy, if I'm not mistaken, half of that is in medical care, in which we move people off of state programs and other distribution programs in the federal government and put them on veterans benefits. Mm-hmm. So for a measly $2 million, we have put $1.4 billion back into the system, of which at least half of that would have been Medicaid, Medicare, or other aid dollars and health care dollars are out there. Am I missing something here, Andy?
You're not, Mr. Senator. And for the record, Andy Smith from the Association of Oregon Counties, Chair Lively, members of the committees. So we have that data. You've seen it before. Right. But what I thought, just to emphasize what Cameron and his team did today on this, is a different angle of the same trend of funding that you've seen. So these aren't these numbers aren't fantasy. I mean, we have a cost, we have a record. I can pull you up the website right now. You could see it. You could see it for every state in Oregon. You can see, for every state in the country. You can see it for every county in Oregon, what this trend line looks like. So these are real dollars, absolutely.
And correct me if I'm less than missing it, because you know they put this together in an interesting way. But in a nutshell, if we spend $78,500 of lottery money for a new VSO, that VSO is going to generate $5.2 million a year in rate of return to the state of Oregon. Half of it likely to be healthcare dollars.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's been a long day, and I'm a Marine, not quite able to keep up every math, but it is an incredible return.
So here's
the $2.5 billion total annual.
Director, you're digging a hole. Don't worry, Andy.
It's about one point.
Here's my point. My point is this is not to you, Director, because you haven't spoken. My point is as the Chief Financial Officer of the state of Oregon needs to have an economics lesson here. I don't think it's the governor. I mean, the governor hasn't seen this, and unless you're going to tell me you had a personal one-on-one and the governor said, go butcher veterans, and I don't think that happened. The chief financial officer needs to have a financial discussion here of what we're talking about, because at least half of this money we go to comes back in Medicaid, in the Medicaid forms, the healthcare formulas, and everything else like that, and it then allows us to go out and help needy families, disabled, not argue about OPI or any of these other things that are out there. And I think that's the key thing that needs to be driven home here is that, you know, veterans are serving twice. If we go out and get this money, okay, from the federal government back, we get it back. And it's the same like Jim said earlier. And then we can get federal matching for a deal. The bottom is, you know, we need to stop budgeting for our nose in front of us and start budgeting out. Because when we first did this, everybody thought we were nuts, Sal. Oh, we fought tooth and nail to get this money. And we have one...
We weren't really sure of ourselves either.
Yeah, we were. Come on. You're in the Navy. Okay, you got this. So my point is, colleagues, is this is worth fighting for, because if you want to fund OPI, if you want to fund expanded Medicaid or anything like that, here's the case, the pot of gold is right here. And they cannot diet. This is not discretionary funding at the federal level. If we go ask them and they have to do it, they must fund it regardless. So just keep in mind, that's the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow.
Representative Parrish.
So I'm glad you came back up, because I do have a question about the number of veteran service officers at 85. What, do you have a breakdown of who they are? Are they county? Are they nonprofit? You know, I mean, it'd be nice to see sort of what you've got an assumed cost down there of 78. We heard Ken Kraft from VFW say they can get that done for less. But are these all like government FTE? In some level of government, are they sort of a hodgepodge?
Correct. Mr. Chair, Representative Parrish, the 85 is that mix of simply county and statewide veteran service officers. The vast majority of those are county VSOs, both funded out of that local level and with the state pass-through dollars.
Is there any actual functional difference other than nonprofits have a different cost basis to do VSO work? Is there a functional difference in the work end of... you know, work product that a nonprofit would do versus a county?
Mr. Chair, Representative Parrish, members of the committee, I think the central difference that was voiced here today is that perception of, you know, often folks think we're the federal VA, not that advocate in their corner. How do we present ourselves like that? But also, a nonprofit is a very different channel. Some of the similar discussions we've had across crisis lines and suicide prevention, it's one thing to call the Department of Defense line or the federal VA line. It's another thing to call the Lines for Life community nonprofit fronting line. So I think it's a matter of perception of who is that advocate in your corner, not necessarily the quality of that claims work and representation.
I think my comment to that is as we have limited dollars, whether we get the full $10 million bought back in by ourselves or not, is that, you know, we need to include that my intuition says we need to include that mix, because it can be bought for a little bit less and the quality is arguably the same, and we have got to stretch these dollars as far as we can stretch them to get to the biggest bang for your buck, because depending on which number you use, we have 320,000 veterans or 350 in the number, everybody reports it differently. But the average caseload is about 4,000. To your 85 people, that's a 4,000-person potential caseload. And there's just, I mean, we're living it. We're still living it. 5 years later, we're still living it. We'll hear about it until that's actually done. it's too much for those folks.
And
it's too huge of a caseload.
Mr. Chair, as Representative Parrish, members of the committee, it is that volunteer-based model to try to get leverage out of those national service organizations. Simply the outreach that they provide community by community can never be duplicated by full-time employees at any level of government. We are going to continue to invest at our level, at the county level, with tribes and other partners. But that community stepping up is what is ultimately going to match that top-heavy system of the federal VA big behemoth.
And Andy, the communities, the counties are great. I know our county has made personal, you know, investments at the county level. You guys have done yeoman's work. Jennifer's on, you know, my staffer's on one of your committees. And so I just really appreciate your strong opposition to the governor's budget and making that unanimous out of AOC. So thank you for that work.
Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. This is more of a comment, but you can add in if you'd like, Director Smith. I want to echo everything that Senator Boquist said about the value and the compounding value of getting veterans off of state systems. We have a package of proposals coming from the Incarcerated Veterans Task Force that actually not only will help in ways the traditional conversion from state system to federal system helps, but also in terms of making communities safer by actually potentially making recidivism rates go down. I offered a letter for consideration today as basically a framework of what I hope we can do. Earlier it was mentioned that really this fight's going to be at the ways and means level, and I absolutely agree with that. I also agree with Senator Boquist's perspective that the budgetary arm of the executive branch needs to be educated. And what I'm hoping is that as we move forward into the next session, we can use this forum to bring forward every possible program and the potential benefits to not really so much in this forum fight over the dollars and cents, but to talk about the potential capability and the potential availability of benefits that can stem from programs that we have been working on as concepts over the last 8 to 10 years. I think that the fight at the Ways and Means level and the discussion of what people and the tangible ideas and pictures of what people can get for veteran services coming out of the policy committee is actually the right combination. So I'm hoping that we can move forward that way and focus on the positive. This is a place to start and getting the veterans community united and hopefully making a historic impact. So,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Evans, we're simply thankful that you didn't propose another task force immediately here today.
Two more coming.
We're not finished yet, Director.
But literally, the arguments that we have heard here today on that economic impact, they were what got House Joint Resolution out of this building in February. They are what resonated to the Oregon voters. They are what is sinking into our county commission partners, our community organization partners. We are at a critical turning point where we've now, with that dedication of resources, this conversation is going to be elevated at a higher level than we've seen before.
Andy.
Mr. Chairs and members of the committees, two other things quickly for the record. So on the return on investment, I think at the hazard of not being correct, but reading this again, I think so that for the $78,000 investment in a veteran service officer, wherever they sit, it looks like the return to me is $1.78 million. So that would be the multiplier.
Right.
I know. So I think we have it. I mean, I think we've rolled it up. We don't have the number in terms of the state revenue GF impact, but I think that should be possible to get. The only other thing that I would have had on behalf of our commissioners are really two things. Is one is on the resolution. We'll make sure that gets in the record. But that's really not meant for you. It's meant for the colleagues that haven't had really the level of engagement and leadership that you've had. So I guess to end, what I think one of our best arguments for you and for us, I think for our commissioners, that in the voters pamphlet in terms of voter intent, so you submitted this. This was three of you signed this on behalf of everybody else here. The legislative argument in support, it's just to read from that submission, in addition to current state funding for veterans, Measure 96 will provide. So you have that as a record of legislative of voter intent. That's what they voted upon. That's in the pamphlet. I think that's an important argument to make to your peers. We're going to make that in terms of our commissioners to the members and the Ways and Means side. So we think that record is there, and that's, you know, step one is to capture the resource that we think the voters decided they wanted to give.
Thank you. Senator Olson, please.
I've been pretty quiet tonight, but I'd like to just make this point.
I think if you could, and I don't want to have you be the bearer of bad tidings, but you should be, and I know she's your boss, so it's going to be very difficult. But she, the governor, has done a great disservice to every veteran in this state by reducing the budget by $10 million. Not only that, instead of this august body working to look at the dollars that we have and how we can better serve veterans, we've spent hours and hours of time discussing what we lost instead of moving forward. And that's the greatest disservice she has done to veterans. Not only has she infuriated the veteran base by withdrawing the $10 million, but she's infuriated me by making us work on this issue when we should have been looking to the future to see how we could better benefit all veterans with the $10 million had it been in place. And it's unfortunate because I look at the fact that we've got a budget increase of $1.3 billion and everybody talks about shortfalls and cutting budgets. Well, to be honest with you, if somebody told me my salary was going up by 20% or 10% or 8%, I wouldn't go back and complain to my boss that, hey, it's not big enough because I want to buy more than what I can afford. So I just want to make that point when you talk to the governor, and I know it's going to be difficult to say, hey, madam, they're really unhappy with you. She should understand that. But the fact is that we've wasted a tremendous amount of time trying to get back to where we were instead of moving forward to where we should have been.
Thank you. My comment.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, members of the committee, I have nothing but a positive spin on this. I think it is hugely powerful that on this horrible transportation day, we did have a packed house of the veterans community. Often it has been crickets in this committee room. And I think we have the attention of the veterans community, and that is a powerful advocacy to channel to the goodness of our works. And again, it is in a very difficult budget. In the governor's budget, it is a total funds significant increase to the tune of almost 90% for veteran services across total funds. And what we are talking about is the depth of that investment, the further of that investment. No other agency has as good a budget as ODVA right now. And we are blessed to have that kind of advocacy for further investment. But this is every policy option package that we presented is in the governor's budget, not necessarily at the full funding level that we requested in agency requested budget, but I would never expect, no agency director would ever expect all of their policy option packages to be embedded in the governor's budget. And that is simply because of the community support for our efforts and what we've done over the years.
Sure, go ahead.
Memorial Day last year, 2015, the governor and I both gave speeches at Willamette National Cemetery and talked about how important veterans were to America and to the state of Oregon. And I don't mean to get upset about this, but to sit there and say that we got 90% of everything we wanted, no, we didn't. We lost $10 million. And to me, that was a slap in the face of every veteran in this state for her to stand there last year and say how important they were and then turn around and withdraw $10 million after 84% voted to say, we like your budget, we like everything you get, plus we want to add on $18 million to make it so much better for the veterans. It's appalling, and it upsets the hell out of me that she did that. And no matter how you want to spin it positively, we get hosed.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
That's what happens when you keep me late and I'm hungry.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank all of you for the time. Obviously, we're going to have a lot more conversations before this is all resolved.
Thank you.
Conversations before this is all resolved.
Thank you.